Yeah.
Let's be in order, please. Mr. Grumman, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to reiterate, Mr. Nigam, what will this 88 megawatt peaker cost per kilowatt month in the first year?
In looking at the revenue requirement, this is from MDU 109, and taking out for variable O&M and also the cost of gas that was a part of the $14.4 million revenue requirement comes up with a monthly capacity cost of $12.75.
Thank you. What is the expected capacity market revenue the company will receive for this capacity from MISO on a kilowatt per month basis in the first year?
The first year, we would use this capacity to serve our load, so it basically we'd self-schedule it in. There's no cost. So basically what the cost of the capacity is what the cost that our load pays because we don't have an excess.
One second, Your Honor. So just to clarify, does that or what you're indicating to me is that the MDU will receive no market revenue from MISO for this capacity?
We use the capacity for our own resources. We talked about how we've got a deficit of 149 megawatts. So it's used to reduce that. So we'll basically use all that capacity in the first year to meet our requirements. So the only way you get into revenues in the auction is if you had an excess.
So just to be certain, so the customers are going to be paying the full $12.75. Is that correct? There's not going to be any kind of offset from MISO revenue or anything like that?
That would be what has been indicated would be included in the rate base for the revenue requirement.
Thank you. Before it was indicated that there's a similarity between fuel costs between a 20-year PPA, i.e. Tilton, and this 88-megawatt peaker. I guess our question is that there is one differentiation, though, isn't there, between that similarity in that if you have the fuel costs and you have a 20-year PPA or a 10-year PPA, when that's done, isn't it in fact that you can reassess in that if you own this peaker, you're going to be set on that fuel price because you own the system, whereas a PPA, once that expires, you can reassess to other technology, where be it be more efficient, or there would be some type of fuel that's cheaper. Would that be correct?
You are right. At the end of a PPA, I mean, you're looking for a replacement. And so, but then you're left to whatever the market might be for alternatives, which could be the same fuel source or it could be something else.
Mr. Nigam, is it true that as part of this project, you're going to be, you're requesting to put in a 10-inch gas line? Is that correct?
That is the request, yes.
Okay. What is the actual line that would be needed to service this 88-megawatt peaker? Is it something less than 10?
I believe the size of the pipe just to serve one 88-megawatt turbine is an 8-inch pipeline.
What are your future plans, I guess, for this further capacity that's provided by the larger diameter pipe?
The pipeline itself is proposed to be, I think it's 24 miles in length. And so of sizing that pipe and the incremental cost, part of that is we've talked about the optionality at Heskett Station. So we've looked at a couple things. One is the pipe is sized large enough that we could basically install two 88-megawatt resources at Heskett Station based upon that pipe. Or the other one is, if needed, there would be sufficient volume in the pipe to basically repower both the Heskett boilers on natural gas.
Before, previously in your, I guess, our cross-examination, you discussed WAPIT network service costs. Does a requirement to pay for WAPA network service depend on locations?
It does. That's how the calculation is done, is to look at load pockets.
And could you further expand what locations in particular?
I think we would look at about 20 load pockets when we've looked at this previously. So basically Bismarck-Mandan is a pocket, and because of the transmission around it, it stretches all the way from the Wishick-Ellendale area all the way up to Beulah is kind of in one pocket. Now, Dickinson is kind of a pocket by itself. You get into that Bowman area is kind of an area by itself, and most of the little western, major western cities are all pockets by themselves.
You said Bismarck-Mandan pocket. Is Heskett included in that pocket then?
Yes, it is.
In one of your previous exhibits, I believe it's that in part of MDU 111, you discuss a WAPA cost. You included these WAPA costs in your exhibit, and you charge it to other MDU. Or I guess my question is, were the WAPA costs in particular, were they that were included in your exhibit, were they charged to other MDU purchases that are currently expiring? For instance, WE purchases or that WE purchase agreement that you had discussed?
Well, it wouldn't be a charge to a resource, even if it deals with, you know, the Illinois proposal. It's an offset to cost that we would incur. So it's really, rather than a charge to the Illinois, it's really an offset, more of a benefit to the Heskett location. As far as the WE Energy's proposal, it expires in May of 2015. And so from the standpoint of we're still under the existing WAPA transmission service agreement, so the charge isn't applicable.
What is the net present value difference between Tilden and the 88-megawatt peaker if you exclude the newly developed IS WAPA charges?
Objection in the form of the question. In terms of newly developed, this is an existing WAPA tariff. It just becomes applicable to us upon the expiration of our contract. This isn't a quote, newly developed.
Sorry. I'll strike newly, then, if you want to proceed with answering the question.
Could you repeat the question, please?
What is the net present value difference between Tilden and the 88-megawatt peaker if you exclude the developed IS WAPA charger, WAPA charges?
I don't have that number in front of me. I'd have to calculate it.
Okay. If you could please calculate, how long would that take to calculate?
The sheet that I had to develop, the page is basically on my laptop. It would just take around maybe the simplest way.
Perhaps the best way to proceed then is I could probably just recall you later. You could do your calculation. Sure. And then that's acceptable, Mr. Coons.
That's fine.
Okay. I have no further questions then.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
I just had a couple questions about the IRP and the potential repowering or whatever of the Heskett. And as I understand, that particular advantage or benefit was not necessarily quantified and run through the IRP, but don't you think perhaps it should be, since it's so central to, you know, lease cost and resource, the utility of your resources?
The optionality is, in a sense, modeled inside the pricing for the combined cycle resource today. Because the combined cycle resource pricing assumes that you've got a greenfield site. So it basically looks as that optionality exists. So from the standpoint of if you just wanted to put a combined cycle resource, in a sense, that pricing represents, if it's a greenfield, you could put that on without any of the synergies or benefits of repowering with Unit 1 at Heskett Station. The place you get into is there's nothing that's economically driving the retirement of the Unit 1 boiler, and so what happens is you basically have to replace that resource with something else then. So where you really get into the place is when something comes along whether it's environmental or if there's cost or equipment type pieces that say maybe we need to look if it makes sense to put the dollars into this project at that time versus now taking that optionality piece. And that's where the savings will come of saying we could potentially use that as an option in the future based upon, you know, when we get to the time to retire that plant.
Okay, thanks. That's all I have.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
Sure, thank you. And thanks, Darcy, for your testimony. The I basically understand, especially after some of Mr. Grumman's follow-up, with regard to the resource adequacy construct and how MDU will recover its costs. And from what I understand, as you describe self-scheduling, what that means is that to the degree that you're still short on capacity, or at least to the degree that all of the capacity will be used by MDU for its purposes, you just recover that straight from the ratepayers. You don't have to interact with any sort of capacity market. Is that
correct? The self-scheduling removes it from the market so that if you, in a sense, if you have capacity and load all in the same zone, you can net those out. So then all that goes off to the auction is either load that you're short or excess capacity that you have that would get put in.
Do you have a sense for how this is going to fly, basically? I mean, as I understand it from our past discussions that we've had on separate proceedings, the MISO, to a great degree, is responding to, in setting up a resource adequacy construct, is responding to challenges that it's faced on its eastern side of its border, where you have utilities, especially in restructured states, jumping to the PJM, which has a more full, robust capacity market. Is there a risk that if MISO isn't able to sell this at the FERC, that it is forced to adopt a more robust capacity market, and does that have an impact on the scenario that you've laid out? There's a lot of speculation in that question, I realize. I'm just trying to assess risk if they decide, now you need I think a more PJM-like market.
I think there's two risks that are out there. One is that the rules themselves are still not approved by FERC. The other one that's a part of this is exactly the mechanisms of how the auction will work isn't called out in the tariff. It comes up in a business practice manual. Mm-hmm. So MISO is still working through that through their supply adequacy working group. They're still talking about those mechanics as far as all the pieces. You know, there are parts that are called out in the tariff that kind of give the bookends to it. And the other one that's a part of this is, as you talk about the restructuring states, there is sort of a discussion or place around that portability of capacity. And there's sort of that study that's done capacity portability, particularly with the PJM seam. What does that mean and kind of what are the implications? And so some of that kind of looks at what are those limits? They're almost like another zone. What are the limits as far as how much can move across and how much actually will? And you sort of end up in the place speculation as well. If somebody sits on one of those seams, can they take a resource and basically jump back and forth across that seam every year? Hmm. And then what effect does that have?
Okay, so when you earlier in your answer described the risk that I see, could you give me an example of, I mean, what would be a bad outcome if the risk happens?
The example was at least I had in my rebuttal testimony we talked about on the overview slide is of looking at zone one where we're in, and if we end up becoming capacity deficit and there becomes some situation where you're limited on how much you can import, export from a neighboring zone, either because of those transfer limits or they don't have anything. And so the bookend on that on the high end is right now it looks like the auction itself either starts at cone, the cost of new entry on the top end, or some multiple of cone. So if it starts at cone and you're deficit, that's basically what load you're short is going to pay.
Okay, so
and then the flip side, you go to another zone, and if they have an excess or some ability to move across the seam that could move it in, the question is, well, what's the pricing in this other
zone? And that's the risk you're laying out if
correct.
Say, the Illinois option was selected.
And that's the one we could basically buy capacity in Illinois.
Right.
We have to basically sell it into that zone and get paid whatever that zone price is. We have no load, so it can't self-schedule.
What happens to the cone penalty money? Does MISO then take that money and go out and procure
MISO
capacity,
doesn't,
or how does, or is mean, who gets it?
That's kind of one of those, if you look for that, I don't know that there's necessarily a party that gets it. It's more of an incentive. But if you get into a deficit, any surplus dollars that are collected, even though the market could be short, because MISO doesn't build anything, that it's really meant to incentivize people to basically look to bid stuff. Timing-wise, the question is how fast you could get something in if you got to Cone.
Right.
But the other one is the dollars themselves.
If somebody's writing a check out to
– it goes back
– somebody.
Well, there's places from some of these hedges. So if there's extra dollars collected, they go back to some of who's got grandmothered agreements, who's got these hedges. And then if there's still dollars that are left, I believe it goes back to anybody who has capacity in that zone.
So basically, write down MISO's administrative costs.
No, it doesn't go there. It goes back to the excess, goes back to the generators or to fund some of those other hedges across some of the existing zones.
Okay. Are you able to tell me after 2015, when the proposed plant would go online, what would MDU's fuel mix by resource be, both in terms of capacity and energy? Is that contained in the testimony somewhere?
I believe it's contained on a capacity-wide. It's in the IRP. I think we looked at that.
Excuse me?
In our integrated resource plan.
In the IRP, okay.
Yeah. I don't have that right in front of me, but it was contained within there.
Does the IRP also identify at the end of the time period that's identified, is it 2030, something like that, where the number of new CTs are proposed to be added, at least as of this time, what the end, say looking 20 years down the line, fuel mix would be?
That's not contained in there. I guess that isn't one of those pieces when we look at the resource plan of saying particularly that far out. That those are all the ones that affect. That's why every 2 years we basically update it and rewrite it of saying, okay, more on the short-term basis, but then, you know, those 20 years out are more of kind of, you know, what's a trend or at least help you decide, you know, the types of things to continue to look at.
Sure. Trying to figure out how exactly to ask this question. And I think it gets to something that Commissioner Kalk had brought up earlier about the idea of how do you decide to add incremental pieces as opposed to just building a larger plant right now? And I look ahead at that, what would be proposed in the IRP right now, and if you add up the different CTs, I think it comes out to about 300 megawatts or ballpark.
Sure.
Over the next, say, 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
To what degree does MDU do calculations to figure out, are we better off adding these incremental CTs, or would we be better off just simply being part of a bigger project right now?
I think
how is that cost? I mean, there must be some sort of net present value calculation.
Well, I think from the standpoint of bigger projects, as Ms. Domburg said, we've looked at those. You know, and there's at least three coal projects that we've looked at. You know, the other one of taking a look, there's nothing on the horizon. We're not seeing anything. If you look at building excess additional capacity, certainly there's a revenue requirement that goes with that. So you've got to recover it from somebody. And the question is there enough in the market, whether it's in pool sales of energy or somebody is willing to purchase that capacity at your cost to justify making that bigger investment? And we've kind of looked at the time now. I think we're kind of into a balanced approach. If we need 150 megawatts, you know, we're not trying to overbuild. We're trying to build this 88. We've gone off and we've looked at 25 megawatts of demand supply, because that reduces that requirement as well. 70% of those payments go back to our customers who participate. And so now we're back into just, you know, that smaller amount that's left that either, you know, potentially we find a shorter-term capacity agreement. Maybe we find, you know, we decide we want to keep it in the auction for a little bit is the best place. But we're looking at 6% from kind of a risk management versus having this 25% number that's out there. So I think it's more of a balanced approach is where we've gone based upon how we got here, what we've done in the last few years. And then, you know, trying to be, you know, conscious that, you know, there are other changes that may be in front of us.
But as much as anything, it sounds like it was just a practical reality that you were butting your head up against with regard to larger central generating units. Is that right?
Well,
I mean, just the feasibility, it wasn't working out, so you skip by it. Is that?
I don't know if it's so much we skip by it. I mean, from the standpoint is we have a need, so the question is how do you continue to fill that need? And if you don't have anything particular on the horizon that says here's this, you know, more of a concrete plan for a long-term, larger resource, either you're just continuing to always just keep buying from others and you just kind of keep hoping that it's out there. And as we've gotten to 25% of our need is now in that basket. You know, we're in the other place. If we look at our generating units and we take out Unit 2 at Glendive, which came online in 2003, all the rest of them are more than 30 years old. And so now you've got this whole other generating mix except this one resource that's all 30 years older or greater. And that's not getting any younger. And the more we keep pushing it out, we have no way that we're backfilling in for what at some point is going to come another potential need.
Could you follow up a bit on our energy efficiency discussion that we had earlier? I understand Ms. Stomberg's response in part to be that, look, I mean, the commissions in our area have engaged in a lot of, at least encouraging, sort of social engineering. Nonetheless, describe to me how energy efficiency is taken into consideration, because it is from as a cost-benefit analysis, isn't it?
Correct.
So that I think I recall this correctly from the IRP, and you can affirm it. But basically, all cost-effective energy efficiency is considered. Is that correct? So in other words, is it considered a resource just like any other, but if it doesn't meet a cost-benefit test, it's not accepted? Is that?
You're right. There is a cost-benefit test that goes with those. And some of the way, my understanding of how we look at energy efficiency, I mean, you can do programs that have a cost, and particularly those are compared like a new resource. And really the ones that we define and we have a program cost, or there's some rebates we get back to customers, we can quantify and say, here was this cost to put in, and here's an actual number of customers who signed up for that. So that kind of has a cost-benefit test, and it goes in as a resource. You know, we know indirectly if we do advertising campaigns or just because, you know, other programs exist, customers make those choices themselves. So we don't try to quantify that or take credit for it. So if we look at the number of energy efficiencies, we're really just talking about the programs that we're sponsoring. They're either dollars for or there's some way, and we can get some sort of measurable number of who those individuals are. And one of the things we're doing, or was in the resource plan, you know, we've included a goal, which I think is a quarter of a percent per year. And it's probably could seem small compared to others. You know, we're looking at doing a potential study, particularly in Montana, and looking to have some applicability of that back as far as what we find, you know, at least to the entire system. So we are doing more, you know, but we're looking to do some studies of more of the broader potential programs, find their costs, and see what the penetration rates.
Sure. I'm just trying to put some context. Sometimes North Dakota is criticized for not being as aggressive on EE as some other states. And I always tell folks, it's not that we don't, and I think this is true and you can confirm it, it's not that our utilities don't look at it. It's just that the margins are so much less because our energy costs are so low that we adopt all cost-effective energy efficiency. It's just that the number of programs that qualify under that cost-effectiveness test are not the same as they would be if you had 15 cent or 20 cent a kilowatt hour rates. Is that correct?
Correct. I think as Ms. Stomberg said, based upon the prices, I mean, it becomes like more of a customer choice. And from the indirect side, the customers may make those choices because they're not programs we sponsor, though, when they change out CFLs or sometimes depending on appliances that they put in, you know, we just don't take credit for those.
Sure.
They're doing it. They're occurring out there. But the way that we're doing our tracking, we don't have those indirects.
You had mentioned in the North Dakota wind proposal that it was for energy only. Is there no capacity credit that would be given for that whatsoever?
That you have, when you put in a generator interconnection request, you have two types. One, it can be an energy resource, an ER designation, or the other one can be a network resource, NR. Okay. If you end up being a network rate resource, you get capacity credit for it. If you're an energy-only resource, you only get energy. So there's a little bit of different modeling study that's done to see what the impacts are on the system. And that resource is just an energy-only resource, an ER designation.
Okay. Can you give me an idea in how often do you expect this CT to run? And you can define your own sort of time parameters. But, I mean, as I understand, it's primarily it's been described as a peaking resource. Sometimes we hear about some of our utilities' intermediate resources, then you hear about baseload resources. Could you kind of define how often you expect this to run?
Yeah, I think I indicated that based upon the modeling that we had in Aegeus, and if we look at the resources that are added in 2015, you know, was expecting something around that 10% number.
Thanks. Interesting. One or two last questions. We had quite a bit of discussion with Mr. Grumman about the transmission costs that were added in, the WAPA IS transmission charges on the confidential side-by-side comparison. We don't need to go off the record because I'm not going to ask anything specific about that. But is there anywhere in the testimony submitted that tries to add in the potential MISO transmission costs, or is that where you were getting into discussion about you just don't know because it's the rules of the road aren't known yet? If you went with the Illinois plan.
If we would have went with the Illinois project, and in order to have that financial hedgeability, so if we would have entered into the agreement prior to July 15th of 2011, in order to make sure that there was no pricing difference from what we had for capacity in Illinois to basically what our load would pay, we'd have to get a transmission service request.
Okay.
So we go out, we put in, we get that study. It ends up being an AND-type rate. So you'll basically pay the MISO Schedule 7 for firm point-to-point transmission plus any upgrades that are required. And if you go back and look at what the current MISO Schedule 7 is, it's $2.44 right now.
Okay.
So then if you multiply that times if we just assume 88 megawatts, not the whole 176, and multiply that by 88 megawatts and then times 12 months, it ends up being today's dollars, that's $2.69 million.
Okay. I'm going to take one more. This is my last question. I'm going to take one more run at this because although there was a lot of discussion on it, I'm not sure that I'm 100% crystal clear on it, which is the last point on your WAPA transmission service, page 22 of your PowerPoint, which talks about generating resource at Heskett could be used to offset the need for WAPA transmission service. Can you describe that just one more time, this idea of an offset?
Sure.
Because I'm almost thinking, I mean, if you're adding a resource right in the middle of kind of the western edge of MISO where you've got this and you're maybe interacting a lot with your WAPA IS that you're actually using more of their service. But
if we go back and we end up doing this study to seeing what level of megawatts or load that we can serve from our resources.
Mm-hmm.
So if we end up taking Bismarck Mandan, we look at this area. And what we'll end up doing is we basically take all the WAPA facilities and disconnect them from ourselves. So we don't have the connections at East Bismarck, and we take the connections at Heskett. There's the 230 line that goes through there. We take those out.
Just because you have a big load sink right here, and you happen to have Heskett here, you can just serve it locally.
Correct. And you're not relying on transmission.
Okay.
And so if we look at Bismarck Mandan, it becomes strategic because it's our biggest load pocket. And if we get a resource here and it can offset some of those costs, we're finding some way, you know, to mitigate that effect that, you know, that we're expecting to happen come beginning of 2016.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. Thank you, Darcy. And I, Tony pretty well exhausted my line of questions. So what I'm going to do instead is, I'm going to ask one specific question. Do you recall or can you remind me what the incremental cost of those 2 extra inches of pipe are to feed?
I think it's in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2 million.
Well, my question is, and maybe I'll make a statement, and I think it's been alluded to. The best way I can express it is to make this statement. Personally, watching all of this, listening to this, and reading all this, it looks to me like MDU is preparing to build a combined cycle plant in Mandap. But to be honest, I mean, that's what it looks like to me. And I get the sense that we don't want to talk about it like that, but rather talk about this smaller plant, but just in case. And so I'm a little bit, I guess, I'm not frustrated, mind you, but I'm a little bit curious as to is my instinct accurate? And if it isn't, fine, but if it is, why don't we just talk about a combined cycle plant in Mandan?
No, from my standpoint and in my knowledge, that's not what we're looking at doing at this point, of advocating, at least at this point, you know, building that combined cycle there. What we looked at is, when we looked at places to build potential generating sources, we looked at a number of sites. And certainly if we end up looking at the Heskett site, because we have other generation there, the big benefit we get is the synergies. And the other one is, at some point, we're not saying this is occurring, but at some point, something's going to happen with that Unit 1 boiler. We don't know when it's going to happen or what, but if that ends up being the case, there is an ability, if we locate a resource there, not that we're saying we're looking at doing that or that's the next thing you're going to see from us, we're basically saying there's an optionality that we could capture.
So then at this point, is it prudent to approve a 10-inch pipe when an 8-inch pipe will do for what we're talking about at this point?
And I think when we look at the incremental cost of the pipe, you know, it's small. If we get in a situation where we start looking at where to add another turbine, or if we had to look at, you know, something would cause, you know, us to look at repowering one of the existing Heskett coal boilers on gas, we've got that capability for just a few dollars that we incrementally put in the ground on top of this. Otherwise, we're back looking at spending much more significant dollars in upgrades, you know, either pressure on the pipe or putting in a second pipe. So it seems to be at least a prudent piece because of optionalities that it gives us down the road at this point in time.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Calk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Dorsey, for your testimony. I mean, Commissioner Kramer was thinking the same exact thing. Why don't we just say we're going to build something big and build it now? I mean, that's where I'm at. I mean, you talk about 43 megawatt plants coming every so many years to meet a growing demand, and I guess I'll back up and come back to that. But walk me through how you take your integrated resource plan, submit it every 2 years, and then you submitted the request for proposals, the RFP, and then how you tied that back in together. I know you went through it again, but can you kind of give me the Reader's Digest version again?
Sure, and I think, you know, certainly every 2 years we go around and basically prepare the integrated resource plan. I think because in recent years, because of the capacity need that we have, now, and also when we were looking at the expiration of the Antelope Valley Station, you know, agreement, we certainly got into RFPs at the same time because they're an option to what would be a self-build that you'd have in a resource plan. So you do that comparison. If you end up in a situation where you would have an excess amount of capacity, there certainly wouldn't be any need to be going out for an RFP at that point in time, because you're not looking to contract something. You're asking for bidders to give you bids to something that you don't need.
Sure.
Okay, so based upon...
When you made the decision to go out with the RFP on this particular project, if you will, is that somewhere in the record what that looks like? Because it seems to me like what you're asking for really obviously determines what you get. And some of the things it looks like now maybe you've got that maybe you if you wrote in a different proposal, you maybe wouldn't have got some of those projects.
We tried to write it as broad as we could. You know, I think we were looking for resources from 25 to 225 megawatts. We were looking for a start date, which was in 2015, because that's when we knew our other agreement ended. We were looking for five-year terms with five-year extensions that were a part of that. From a resource size, we said anything. We'll look at energy, we'll look at capacity, we'll look at coal, we'll look at wind, we'll look at demand response. So we tried to cover as much as we could, not exclude things, and basically say, find out what the market had available.
But were you looking for a peaking resource in that request for proposal?
No, not specifically, no.
But then how do you get from that to what this is now, a peaking resource? It seems to me that if you needed a peaking resource, that should have been what your request for proposal asked for.
The place you get to a peaking resource then comes back to when you actually do the model and you take a look for what your capacity need is, and you take a look at your existing energy resources, and as you dispatch them, it'll basically determine the type of resource. I mean, do you need more baseload type energy? Do you need more peaking type energy? And basically, based upon the mix that you have,
okay, now that
basically determines the type of resources the model's going to want to pick.
Okay, that all makes sense. But then you go back to just the reality of you're sitting in the MDU office, and you've got a place sitting over at Heskett that has very good gas supply, that has very good electric transmission, mm-hmm. that has the best water supply, that has the best chance to get permitted. You already know what you want to do. I mean, that's the part I'm having trouble meshing in. Walk me through how that ties in.
Well, when we take a look at resources, and so if we step back when we had our 2009 integrated resource plan, it was showing it wanted to pick a combustion turbine in 2015. At the time, we had done some real high-level screening, maybe pins on a map that said here's six places we looked at on our service territory, if they were self-built. We get around to this, and we end up knowing the model's still probably going to want to pick a peaking-type resource. So if we're going to go off and look at sites, what we'll do is we'll go off and we'll try to develop maybe the more defined costs that end up saying, here's a little more drill down on some of these potentials. And we actually had three sites that we did more of a detailed analysis, basically looking at the pipeline cost for gas, the electrical interconnection, and also the cost of the turbines and the various outputs they got. So we basically had three sites that we basically developed more knowledge on.
Is that the Linton and Richardson
Correct.
Sites?
Okay. Yep. So we looked at those as well. And then in that, you come back to, okay, which one makes the most sense? And that's where you end up with the synergies and at least opportunities that we develop at Heskett Station. Not to say we want to develop a combined cycle, but
okay,
it fills that need.
I'm trying to understand how you get to that decision process. If you intuitively know that's where you're at, you come to that, makes good sense. Why don't you just proceed with that and then find what takes it to back it up instead of trying to run through all these models to get you back to where you know you're headed to? You want to go anyway.
But I think that's where we're at with the models. They end up showing the economic analysis of it as far as from a least cost side, what have you determined for your assumptions, and then basically going and trying to come up with some dollar difference either between sites or saying from an economic, what's the best site?
Yeah, well, that's okay. I think that's where it's interesting. As a commission's, or as an individual commissioner, sometimes I don't think I need all those models telling me all these numbers. I need leadership from the company to say that this is what we think, this fits our intangibles, this is what we need, this is the best sit, and then they come in and you make your case. I mean, because this is a case for 88 megawatts right now, but this could easily, in my opinion, be a case for 176 megawatts to delay future costs, build it all at once. And that's, the, I guess, part of the – when you submit an IRP, are you looking for feedback from us on it, or are you just filing it? How do you view that yourself?
At least for myself, you know, I think we submit it and we'd hope we get comments back. I don't think there's a requirement that we get feedback.
Because we've had that discussion ourselves in the commission a lot of, okay, the place where I would go through an IRP is a rate case. If you give me an IRP and I start giving you comments what not to do, what to do, then it's a very interesting scenario. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I think we probably have to take offline somewhere about the role of the IRPs, because I don't know that it's appropriate for us to comment at that time on those IRPs.
One of the things we've also done
but it's
is
inferred in here, I think, that because you submitted the IRP and we didn't say anything, that we agreed with it.
Well, one of the other things we've done is when we do our IRPs, we have a public advisory group. So we end up getting folks, you know, from various parts of our service territory, and we've had invitations out. And in the past, we've had folks from, you know, the commission staff that have participated in that. So at least to be able to try to get some input or have some dialogue along the way as we end up, creating this plan.
Okay. Let me look through here a little bit here. So if I was to ask just one question of what's the best piece of data that you have that says that this is the best plant to build at this place and time, or at this place and at this time, what would that be? Is there one model that's better? Is there one report? Is there something that says this is what really says this is the best thing to do now?
And for myself, I would go back to it's a combination of a number of pieces of information. And so it kind of drives into almost that gut feeling as you look at all the potential places that we have. I mean, the amount of synergies that we get, and it's also connected to our largest load pocket that we have, and the benefit that that provides for reliability, particularly as we look at growth that occurs and interruptions that can occur on the transmission side, it continues to show, at least where our largest load pocket is, that we've got resources to serve that.
Sure. What would be the – and I know you might not know this, it's kind of off the cuff, but the transmission grid in that area, what would be the max size of generation you could put in this pocket with what the current transmission system would allow? Do you know that off even?
Well, from – And this gets back a little bit to the types of facilities that Montana, Dakota has.
Let's say natural gas.
I know, but the places, most of our transmission is 115,000 volts or less. And so if we end up taking a look at something that's 115,000 volts, we're really talking in resources that are maybe up to 100, maybe 120 megawatts. Otherwise, you've got to upgrade lines to 230 kV.
You must be an electrical engineer. Okay, so 120, give or take.
That's what I would say. Otherwise, we're into some bigger transmission upgrades. And that's the benefit of putting something at Heskett is there's a large 115 kV loop that goes around the area that basically connects all the load in the area to serve all that.
If this 88-megawatt plant gets built and you repower the boilers, if you will, what would that rough megawatt amount come to?
I think it just adds basically 88 above what's currently over there. So we're at 100 plus 88, about 188.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you very much, Dorsey.
Welcome.
Further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Nigam, in response to a request by Mr. Grumman, you gave a first-year monthly cost, revenue requirement cost for the 88-megawatt CT at $12.75 per kW. Is that correct?
Correct.
Did that include the cost that would be avoided, the WAPA transmission charges, if this project were built at Mandan as opposed to off-system somewhere?
No, it did not.
And what would that reduce? Do you have a number that would reduce that $12.75 by equivalent if you considered that offset?
Yes. That number would be an offset of $3.32 a kilowatt month. Therefore, the net cost would be $9.43 a kilowatt month.
Thank you. In response to some questions by Commissioner Clark, you described your understanding of the MISO capacity market and how it would work, and if you were a deficit and there wasn't sufficient capacity that you could buy in that market, you could be subject to these penalties of CONE, cost a new resource or whatever it's called, okay?
Correct.
Do you have an understanding, or is the MISO proposal clear so that you end up in this auction and that zone is short of capacity, period, and you get into a peak situation where because of that shortage, despite the fact that everybody's paid their CONE, and as Commissioner Clark put out, that's just money, that doesn't create generation, how is MISO proposing, or what happens if you're one of the deficit utilities and you weren't able to buy sufficient capacity credits on that annual auction, how are your customers going to get served on that one peak day in the event that the capacity in that zone is less than what the demand is on that particular day? Is that addressed in the MISO proposal, to your knowledge?
I've not seen that in the tariff. And so I think from the standpoint, it's certainly, if it would occur, it does two things. One, it would just drive a system emergency, and it's entirely likely that everyone could basically have to make a corresponding reduction if you were in a limiting or emergency situation. The other one ends up being it certainly could create some new rules as far as resource adequacy goes and as far as priorities, I would think. And the other one that you end up with is sometimes if you end up in a limiting situation, depending upon congestion, depending if you've got resources available, you may entirely likely be able to serve that load. But if you're talking about resources that are deficit over a large zone, you may have some other limitations that basically are impacting the ability to serve loans someplace else on the system.
So one way or another, some load's going to get impacted if the zone is short of capacity. Is that correct?
Correct.
So it could, and so that load might be impacted based upon, like you mentioned, these pockets where there's capacity shortages. It could be based upon system-wide, based upon some sort of priority system in terms of users. Is that a possibility?
Correct.
Or it might be based upon who happens to be short. There might be priorities. If you were one of the utilities that has to be short, you might be looked to shed load before some other utilities which has self-scheduled sufficient capacity. Is that also a possibility?
That's possible.
There was a question by Commissioner Kramer, I believe it was, about the size of the pipe relating to the need or the vision for combined cycle turbine at Heskett. Does the size of the pipe relate more to the possibility of a combined cycle unit as opposed to a second CT? Can you describe that?
I can. The sizing of the pipe is more driven by the ability to locate a second turbine there or to repower the Heskett boilers. If you look at a combined cycle resource, it typically is just taking the heat that's available from the simple cycle turbine and turning that into steam and energy. So there's, unless you put supplemental firing in that unit, there's no additional fuel that's required.
So the exercise of the pipe then would add flexibility in terms of the option to add a second 88 or some lesser size combustion turbine there without going to have to put in a second pipe.
Correct. It doesn't drive the decision of using that as a potential combined cycle location.
Okay. That's all the questions I have, Mr. Nigam.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you. Mr. Nigam, do you have in front of you MDU 101, the application for this 88 megawatt peaker? If not, I can just approach and show you mine.
I do not have it in front of
okay.
me.
Okay. May I approach, Your Honor?
Oh, do I? I just want, oh, I do have it. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. If
yes.
you could proceed to page 4. Now, towards, let me know when you get there.
Yes.
Towards the bottom, I believe the third line from the bottom, there's a $50 million amount. And if you look at the footnote.
On which page?
Oh, page 4, and it would be MDU 101.
Yes.
There's a $15 million amount that's indicated. If you look at the footnote at the very bottom of the page, I believe that indicates for an 8-inch line. So would it be correct that the cost of the pipeline for an 8-inch line would be $15 million? Would you agree with that?
I'm not the one who put this together. And looking at that, it looks like the $15 million would correspond to the 8-inch pipeline.
Okay. If you could next proceed to page 7 of the same document. Now, second line from the bottom indicates a $15.9 million figure plus a $2.5 million figure for $18.4 million in total. Would you agree that that is the cost for a 10-inch line?
And looking at that, that's what the conclusion that I would, okay. would draw.
So 18.4 minus 15 is 3.4. Is that correct?
That would be.
So would you agree that to answer Commissioner Kramer's question for the incremental cost between an 8-inch line and a 10-inch line, that would be $3.4 million?
I would defer that question to somebody who prepared these estimates.
Who would be best to be able to qualify that?
I would say Mr. Mormon
okay.
or Mr. Welty.
All right. I guess the second thing is just a bookkeeping matter. The IRP has been referenced. It was indicated by commission staff that perhaps that should be part of the record. I spoke briefly with Mr. Kuntz. What I propose is that we include as an exhibit RSH 12 and by judicial notice bring in the 2011 MDU IRP. And when you're ready, I'll reference. It's actually filed under a PU number, PU-11-158.
Mr. Kuntz.
We don't have any objection, obviously, to the foundation of this exhibit. I guess I'd like some understanding of the purpose for which it would be offered, so it's clear in terms of how it's being used. I mean, I'm always reluctant when people are taking big documents and dumping them into the record and then something's grabbed out of there without any context or opportunity to explain it, in terms of how it's being used. There's been a reference to it in terms of, what's been shown in it in terms of resources, and I'm fine with that purpose or any other purpose that's been referenced in the hearing, but I wouldn't want it to be used for something that hasn't been discussed in the context of the hearing.
In other words, what is its relevance?
Exactly.
Well, the problem, of course, is, Mr. Kuntz, if we're going to take official notice of the document, then what are you also going to attempt to define a limited purpose? Because once it's in, it's in, and if I agree that it's relevant and it comes in, then I'm not. How do we limit the purpose?
Well, I think from the context of which it's being offered. If it's being offered for any of the purposes that have been discussed here, I have no objection at all. But as Ms. Stomberg indicated, this document's huge, and somebody can go off and I've not read the IRP, but there's plenty of people in the room who have more familiar with it than I. I'm not sure what all the sections are that are in there and how, somebody can take a section that's completely irrelevant to what's been discussed in the hearing and then try to make something of that in the findings or arguments later on.
It's the nature of being a lawyer, Mr. Kuntz. Well, so, Mr. Grumman, what's the relevance? Relevant to what issues? Relevant to what questions at issue in this case is the document sought?
Well, I mean, part of what was referenced was the, I believe, a fuel cost portfolio. And I think it was, the way it was answered is that that's in our IRP. Plus, I mean, commission staff had asked that they be included into the record. So I guess I didn't expect any objection to this. So I'm not. I guess that's the best way to answer this. I mean, it's not like I'm completely, I have to have this within the record. It's just, again, I didn't expect an objection, so.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Yeah, I think I probably brought it up, but about 50% of the questions today have been responded to with some analysis from the IRP.
Yeah,
did it cover this part of the resource? Did it cover DSM? So if I were to go try to look up, okay, how much DSM was really in the IRP to try to understand part of the transcript, I've got a document now that's not in the record, and so that's why I said I think it needs to be in the record.
That was my sense, actually, that there have been numerous references to the IRP. And so I'm inclined to think that that the document can come in, that is a commission can take official notice of the document and use it with reference to its evaluation of the evidence that relates to the IRP. That seems to work for me. And if in the commission's order it appears that it is used for some other purpose, which you can reasonably argue that is irrelevant, or which somehow the commission has abused its official notice, then I think you have your appeal, Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman, anything further for the record in that regard?
No, Your Honor.
All right. So the commission will take as exhibit, commission will take official notice of the IRP, which is document, help me here, Mr. Grumman, document, it's PU
11-158.
Is that the document number? That's a case number.
It's a case number. It's been filed within the docket, so what I'm requesting is that.
Oh, so you don't have the document number.
We do not, but I'm guessing it might be the only thing in there.
Oh, all right.
Or close to it, right?
That's my understanding, common protocol.
Right. We give it a case number.
I see. Okay. So it's the commission will take official notice of the IRP, which is identified as case number PU-11-158, and which will be identified as exhibit RH-12. Satisfactory, Mr. Grumman?
It is, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
I do have further questions for Mr. Nigam. However, I believe I'm just going to ask them as part of my direct, since that he has to do some calculations. So in that respect, I have no further questions, Your Honor.
All right. Follow up, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
We have no questions. Thank you.
Follow-up. Commissioner Cock.
I forgot to close the loop on the question on the request for a proposal. Is that in the record somewhere right now? Is it in the IRP?
It's in the IRP. It was one of the exhibits to the IRP.
Okay, well, I would, if that would be okay, like to use that in the IRP. Okay. There we go. We got
further questions from the commission. Mr. Kuntz, follow-up.
One follow-up question. On page 7 of the application, you were asked questions regarding the cost of the estimated cost of the 10-inch pipeline there being $15.9 million plus approximately $2.5 million for the tap and border station at the interconnection. Do you see that?
I do.
And I believe Mr. Grumman asked you to add those numbers up to get to 18.4 as the cost of the 10-inch pipeline, correct?
Correct.
The $2.5 million for the tap and border station, would some or all of that, to your knowledge, be incurred for an 8-inch pipeline as well? Would you need a tap and a...
It'd be the same.
That's all I have.
Okay.
Follow-up, Mr. Grumman?
No, Your Honor.
Jeff Kotsacko?
No, thank you.
Any further question from the commission?
Thank you. Well done.
Thank you. Commissioner Clark.
You may want to kick this one to Mr. Mormon, but since questions came up about the pipe, I'll ask him now. And you can deal with it as you wish. Is the pipeline that's being installed, is it treated basically as a private line where it's just MDU using it, so it's not tariffed in any way, so on and so forth, or is there an opportunity for that to become a line, because it, at least as installed, as I understand, has some excess capacity on it that could be used to serve other resource needs, and how would that be handled? I mean, like MDU gas resource needs.
My understanding, at least initially, it was looking at that would just be an electric supply asset. It wouldn't fall under a tariff for other sorts of service for others, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't change at some point.
Okay. Thanks. Would Mr. Mormon have more info?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions from the commission? Follow-up, Mr. Kuntz?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, thank you.
Mr. Nagum, I think you are finally done. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, as I indicated, we have both Mr. Welty and Mr. Mormon here who submitted pre-filed testimony. We did not intend to call them to summarize their pre-filed testimony, but they are available if the commission or staff has cross-examination questions for them. I can pose the question, I suppose, with respect first to Mr. Welty and then with respect to Mr. Mormon.
All right. Mr. Welty, commissioners, are there any questions for Mr. Welty? There are questions for Mr. Mormon, though.
Mr. Mormon, would you like questions, Mr. Mormon?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry, did advocacy staff or commission staff have any questions for Mr. Welty?
Advocacy staff does not.
Okay.
No, we do not. Thank you.
Thanks. Call Mr. Bob Mormon to the stand, please. Please state your full name.
Robert C.
Mr. Mormon, as you know, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Mormon, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
It is.
Now, Mr. Mormon, would you state your full name?
Robert C. Mormon.
And whom are you employed by?
Montana Dakota Utilities.
What's your position with Montana Dakota?
I am the manager of gas supply.
And you submitted pre-filed direct testimony in this proceeding, is that correct?
Yes, I have.
We would offer Mr. Mormon for cross-examination.
Mr. Grumman?
I have no questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I have no questions.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark?
I think you heard my question that I had just asked. Is there... like I said, can you talk a little bit about this particular type of line? And it's specifically designated as an electric supply line, so in that case it's not tariffed, it's just privately owned by MDU, is that correct?
That is correct. At this time we're building this pipe specifically for electric generation at Heskett Station.
Okay. So so the only tariff interaction that you would have would be with the interconnection with Northern Border. Is that correct? I assume they have some sort of tariffed product for that type of interconnection?
Yes, at the Northern Border Pipeline, yes, okay. They would.
And then whatever the electric or whatever the supply energy supply contracts are with the gas marketers. Okay. Is there an opportunity at some point in the future, considering that there may be excess capacity on that, to utilize it as a for some sort of MDU gas supply for other customers? Is that not feasible? What would the steps be if that is feasible?
It runs right through our service territory, as you well know. At this time, we do not have any plans to use it to feed any of our existing customers or new customers. We're currently serving everything from Williston Basin Pipeline. They have adequate capacity. They have the opportunity to expand. So at this time, we have no plans to utilize that as natural gas for our gas customers.
Okay, I'm just trying to explore whether it would be a potential revenue source to help offset the cost of the line itself. I mean, has that been explored or looked at? Or?
No, we did not look at that. If you use it as a multi-user pipeline, you're run into a different set of regulations and guidelines. Now that's a multiple-user type deal, which is something that we would have to consider at the time if we see it feasible to use for natural gas. But
you have certain common carrier and non-discrimination obligations if that happens.
Yeah, exactly right. I believe there's some guidelines that you fall into if you have multiple users on it, being Montana, Dakota Utility, gas, and the electric side.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions from the commission? Mr.
Koch. I just have a quick question that came. I just thought of the. So, how long did the contracts that you enter in with Northern Border on to deliver the gas?
With Northern Border, we're not actually contracting for them to deliver the gas. What we'll do is we are looking at contracting with marketers. They will provide the natural gas service. They will have the capacity on Northern Border, and we will basically pick the gas up at the unit connect with the new pipeline.
So, how long are those contracts typically good for?
You know, the one we asked for in our RFP was for a 3-year contract. Those can be anywhere from 1 year to multiple years, longer than 3 years.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, Commissioner Kramer.
Well, along those lines, Bob, and thank you for being available. When you have a long-term contract, say beyond 3 years for gas, is it an ironclad price, or is it a price range, or how do you do that to make sure that you're adequately protected?
We can go out and ask for a number of. We can ask for a fixed price deal. We can ask for some hedges. There's all kinds of financial tools out there that you can hedge the gas for. You can play the market, purchase on the day market if you want to. So really, the marketers will pretty much entertain anything you take to them. If the electric boys desire to go to a fixed price for the next 2 years or 3 years, I believe we could find a contract that would, a marker that would honor that contract.
Probably not much beyond 3 for a fixed price, do you think?
Marketers get a little bit leery anytime you go past 3 years, yes. Yeah. Price a little bit. 3 years is this typically as long as. And it's basically tied to NYMEX contracts. The NYMEX really isn't forecasted anywhere past the 2 to 3 year time frame.
Very good. Thanks.
Further, Commissioner Clark.
I had asked Andre a little bit about the nature of the firm and interruptible rates that you're getting. Could you talk a little bit more about that again, just fill in the blanks for me with regard to how these particular contracts you've structured are relate to what's firm and what's interruptible?
What we look at doing, being this is a peaking unit, we have to have gas on call 24/7.
Right.
What we approached the marketers about was to provide an RFP to address gas on a 24/7 call, if you will. They will provide us gas on a firm basis on a 24/7 basis. Interruptible really is not an option if you have a peaking unit that is required for their generation.
And do you contract for a certain amount of gas that will be used over the course of a given time period, whether it's a month or a year or so on and so forth? And you can start with that question.
What we look at doing, we know what this generation unit would use. We'd ask for on a daily basis. We may need up to the 25,000 decatherm per day,
okay.
And that's what we based our contracts on.
Okay, and then it's that's the capacity you're purchasing.
Yes.
And then the energy itself, is that done through a variety of instruments, hedges, fixed-price contracts?
There again, we would put that back on the market. The nice thing about doing with a basically a reservation fee for a marketer, mm-hmm. we don't pay for the capacity on a 365 days a year. Excuse me, we only pay for it when we actually use it. There is an annual fee we pay to the marketer for reservation of that.
Okay.
If they have gas delivered to customer A and we need it at our Heskett facility, they would basically deliver the gas
to
us.
They just have to guarantee that it gets there.
That's what we are concerned
about. And whatever they do on the days when you're not using your capacity is their business, and that's
how
they float their model. Okay, thanks.
Further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Kuntz?
Just one. Mr. Merman, could you clarify the cost differences? There's been some question between the 8 and the 10-inch pipeline, and including the cost of the northern border tap.
The initial cost we get, Mr. Nygum stated, was approximately $1.5 to $2 million. It is correct. It's in that range. I know there were some price concerns through the 18.4 and the 5.9 that's in the document, excuse me, for the 8-inch pipeline. I know once the quotes came in, there was some additional, I believe, accounting, I wouldn't say errors, but parameters that were identified by the electric boys, and Mr. Alan Welty could speak more to that than I can.
But you have a tap in either instance, a tap charge on Northern Border, that $2.5 million somewhere in that proximity, whether it's an 8 or a 10-inch line.
It should be very similar in cost, yes.
And the incremental cost between the 8 and the 10 is approximately $1.5 to $2 million. You would agree with Mr. Nygum on that?
That is correct. I believe it's somewhere in $1.6 million.
Thank you.
Mr. Grumman.
I have no questions, Your Honor.
Jeff Goatsacko.
No questions.
Any follow-up by the commission? Commissioner Clark.
Just quickly, and that $2.5 million interconnection tap cost, is that a regulated tariff, or is it a tariffed rate, or is it something that's just negotiated with Northern Border?
That is pretty much a set rate they have for their taps. Now, whether it's in their tariff, I'm not exactly sure. It comes from their engineering group, and I think that is adjusted from time to time as costs either go up or down. Or up, I should say.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Further questions from the commission? Mr. Kuntz, anything further? Mr. Grumman?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeff Gotsenko.
Nothing, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mormon. I wonder, Mr. Kuntz, anything further?
No. Nothing further.
I wonder. We're a little bit previous to a recess, but I'm guessing we're going to start down a long road. So why don't we take 10 minutes to stretch our legs before we get started with advocacy staff.
So we'll do what David Wright said.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
All right, to begin, before proceeding with advocacy staff's testimony, let me comment for the record that I am advised that the IRP, which is Exhibit RH-12, is best identified as docket number 1 of case number PU-11-158. With that, Mr. Grumman, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Advocacy staff calls Richard Hahn.
Mr. Hahn, as you have heard me previously advise other witnesses, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I am required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Hahn, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do so,
sir. Mr. Grumman.
Will you please state your name for the record?
Sir, Richard, middle initial S, last name Hahn, H-A-H-N.
Mr. Hahn, have you had an opportunity to review all of the materials and listen to the testimony today concerning MDU's applications, respective applications for advanced determination of prudence, any certificate of public convenience and necessity?
Yes, I have.
After review of your formed opinions in those regards?
Yes, I have.
If you could offer those opinions and also give to us your logic behind those opinions.
Direct testimony, we reviewed the application for the Oliverton as a
CPCN, thank you, CPCN and an ADP, if that shorthand is okay. We noted that the company does appear to have a need for some new capacity. We agree that this need is driven primarily by expiring capacity contracts, but also by load growth, and we reviewed the company's load forecast, and at a high level, I found that to be reasonable. I also noted that there were certain resources identified in the 2010 RFP, which I believe are feasible and, when analyzed, result in considerable savings relative to the proposed MDU GT unit. Because there are other feasible options that will cost much less than the proposed project, we think there's a possibility that the presumptive presumption of prudence can be rebutted. And so my testimony states that I do not believe that either the ADP or the CPCN should be granted. I do need to note that the two resources that were found to be desirable were a North Dakota wind project and an Illinois combustion turbine project. My testimony and my analysis focused mainly on the Illinois combustion turbine project, or the purchase from the of the output of that unit, because it's a direct competitor to the proposed unit in that's for which the company is requesting a CPC and an ADP. So I'm not recommending that the company be required to purchase the wind. I think that is a decision or a debate that can be put off to a later date. So I'll focus my comments mainly on the this opportunity from an Illinois combustion turbine. And as far as some other comments, if I might, Mr. Grumman, in my pre-filed testimony, I referenced chapter, and make sure I get this right, 49-03.1-04 of the North Dakota Code as setting forth the provisions for a CPCN. The company's pointed out graciously that this chapter of the code does not apply to electric utilities, and they've suggested that chapter 4903 is the proper citation. I acknowledge that Chapter 49-03.1-04 does not apply to electric utilities. That fact, however, does not change my testimony or my conclusions. The five factors that I reference on page 7 of my pre-filed testimony are valid issues to explore when considering an investment in a new power plant. I would also like the opportunity for a brief response to the rebuttal testimony that was previously filed by the company. Ms. Stomberg her rebuttal testimony makes reference that a lease cost is not a requirement of the ADP or the CPCN. And it also states that the project has a presumption of prudence, and I'll accept that. But I don't believe that should be used to argue that the commission can't and shouldn't look at costs. I think the commission clearly should look at costs. And if the commission were to reach a conclusion that there's a better alternative out there, I see no reason why they could not direct the company to pursue that. There are also claimed deficiencies due to the conversion of the proposed combined cycle proposed combustion turbine to combined cycle operation. We've already had lots of testimony on this, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. I just wish to point out that that is an option that Aegis never picked. And we picked it in one high-load case, and it picked it later in the planning period. So I don't think it's really reasonable to say that that's a benefit from the project. It may be, but it's not been shown to be economic. There are also claims about reliability benefits from this proposed project. I have to say that I have not seen any analysis of the reliability
of this area, the company's service territory, the benefits of reliability are quantifiable. They're not some unknown that can't be quantified. In fact, utilities are required to do reliability assessments of their system. In fact, if they're deficient, they need to find a way to fix them. And so this really wasn't something that, in my view, the company studied or analyzed, but I do think they should. Lastly, I'll point out that there are two significant benefits from this Illinois combustion turbine that the company's rebuttal testimony ignores. The first is that it was up to 176 megawatts, and it would preclude the need to go out next year for an RFP, which is something the company has said they're going to do. The LMPs in Illinois are higher than the LMPs here in Montana, so there would be a benefit to having market revenues at those higher prices, and also that the unit in Illinois has a lower heat rate and lower variable cost, which would also provide some benefits that are really not included in the company's analysis. In response to Mr. Nijem, I'll try to be very brief, but there are a lot of points we disagree with, but the two that seem to be the most important relate to the deliverability of the output of this Illinois combustion turbine, either for capacity and or for energy purposes. It was interesting in Mr. Nijem's slide presentation today, there was an implication that capacity prices will be higher in Montana, Dakota Territory, than they will in Illinois. He didn't come right out and say that, but he said that, you know, the MDU, the zone that MDU is in, is short of capacity. I disagree with that. I think if you read the MISO transmission expansion plan, what it says is that that area out by Zone 1 is export constrained, and the area in Illinois is import constrained. This is consistent with sort of the conventional knowledge that power flows from the west towards the east in MISO. And so in every other area of the country where a capacity market has been in place for a while, in an export-constrained area, the prices are lower than they are in an import-constrained area. So I believe that that will be the case here. And so to the extent that Mr. Nijem's analysis is inherently based on that assumption, I have to point out that that is an assumption that I would disagree with. And then regarding the transmission service that they may not need to buy from WAPA, I must admit I'm a little confused by this. When the company raised this issue in its rebuttal testimony, we had a call to discuss it, and I was under the impression that after that call that it had to do with loop flow. And I was confused by that because WAPA's tariff, even though they're not subject to FERC jurisdiction, the Secretary of Energy has ceded jurisdiction to FERC over their transmission rates, and these rates do not charge for loop flow. So I heard today, really for the first time, that it's now the purchase of network service, and that network service depends somehow on the difference between generation and load. I'm further confused by that because network service is a standard product that all FERC OATTs, that's open access transmission tariff, must have, and it's paid for by load, not by how much generation you have. So it isn't clear to me that these costs are appropriate, and I'm not sure that, quite frankly, that they should be included, although I'm a little bit of a disadvantage because I only learned of some of this information today. And then as far as the cost comparisons go, I would like to bring up a couple of my exhibits. The first two will be confidential. So I think this won't take long, but I think we need to go into a confidential session so we can discuss exhibits RSH 9 and 10.
All right. Give me a moment. Mr. Hahn, please. I'll advise you when you may proceed. You may proceed, Mr. Hahn.
I'm going to ask Mr. Diller to bring up Exhibit 9. And this is similar to an exhibit that Mr. Nijem had. It compares the cost of the 88-megawatt combustion turbine project as proposed in this proceeding to the proposal that they got from the owner of the Illinois combustion turbine over the first 20 years. Now, my testimony was criticized because I only looked at the first 16 years. That's because that's all the company published in Aegeus. So I extended this analysis out over the full 20 years. And I did include the variable costs. I know Mr. Nigam excludes them, and he explained why. But in my opinion, it's a legitimate to include these costs because they are real benefits from this project. And as a result of that, on a net present value basis, I find that the Illinois project would save on a net present value basis $59 million over the 20 years. I will note that this excludes any transmission costs that company claims need to be paid to WAPA. And by WAPA, I mean the Western Area Power Administration. And then there was further criticism of my testimony that said something along the lines of the MDU gas turbine will last for 40 years, whereas the PPA was only for 20 years. So I decided to convince myself whether that was a fair comparison. And I produced Exhibit 10, if Mr. Diller, if you would. And this is a similar comparison, except that it goes out for 40 years. And I look at the unit proposed by the company over its 40-year life, which is what they said it would have. And for the first 20 years of the alternative, I assumed the purchase from the Illinois unit. And then I assumed that they would build an 88-megawatt unit similar to what they're proposing in this case, but at a higher capital cost because it's 20 years later. And I escalated this at 3%, which is the escalation rate that the company used. And so this does reduce the benefits because what happens here is in the first 20 years, the Illinois unit cost less. In the last 20 years, the replacement unit cost less. But on a net present value basis, the difference is still a $30 million savings. And just to be fair, what I did is I took that unit that I assumed to be installed in 2035, and I amortized its capital cost over 20 years. So in this comparison, we're looking at 88 megawatts over 40 years, no more, no less in both cases. So I believe it's an apples-to-apples comparison. We can now exit the confidential session, Your Honor, if that's a good time.
Give me just a moment, please. You may proceed, Mr. Hahn.
Lastly, Exhibit 11 shows graphically what we just talked about in Exhibit 10, and I can. This is not a confidential exhibit, because it just contains the summary results. And what you have is that in the first year, the Illinois unit saved $9 million. Now, this is a graph of the cumulative net present value as it changes over time. Sorry for the technical term, but it's a convention that's used in most utility analyses, including the companies. And you can see how that rapidly increases to $59 million over the first 20 years and then declines to the $30 million figure shown in Exhibit 10 over the full 40-year comparison. I'm done with that exhibit if you wish to take it off the right board. So I guess these, in my view, these issues are substantial. It does come down to perhaps whether it's appropriate to include the WAPA transmission costs. I will note that the net present value of those costs that are contained in Mr. Nigam's exhibit is approximately $45 million. And that's a big number. And so it would be, I think, important to make sure that that number is correct. And it would be important, as a preference, it would have been helpful to us in our review had we known this information sooner than we did. With that summary, I will stop there, and that's the summary of my testimony.
Mr. Hahn, do you have any recommendations for the commission?
Well, beyond the recommendation in my testimony, I do have some additional suggestions for what I would call process-related. It seems to me that the development of the record and the analytics behind the company's case could be improved quite a bit. We have seen here where we identified numerous issues with some of the inputs, some of which the company even agrees with. So I would suggest that in future cases that those be reviewed and tightened up. As far as the filing of the case, I think some of the analyses that have surfaced later in the case would be a lot better for everybody involved if they were identified earlier. We went back at LaCapra Associates and reviewed the company's IRP and its filing in this case, and did not see any reference to either bad reliability in the Heskett area or this issue of WAPA transmission costs for out-of-state facilities. And I guess if it does turn out to be as significant as the company asserts that it is, that I think that should be done sooner in the process rather than later. And then I do have a concern about the RFP process itself. I think RFPs are great if they're done right. The concern is obviously if you run an RFP and people think it's not a fair RFP, they're not going to respond. It's a lot of work to put in a proposal for some of these things. And so if certain out-of-state resources aren't going to be given the same consideration, I think you should tell people that up front. And I think that there's a sense of objectivity that is sometimes helpful in running these RFPs. And so in other instances, I have seen where an entity has been brought in. It's called an independent evaluator, and they are brought in to specifically oversee an RFP. And they're a third party that has no ties to the company, to the commission, or to any of the interveners in the case. And what happens is they structure it as a fairly rigid RFP. The company can submit its proposals, but it needs to do so in a sealed envelope, just like the other bidders do. Other bidders are assured then that they have, or can be assured if the process is developed properly, that they do have a fair and objective chance to win a capacity and or energy supply obligation. So I would suggest respectfully that be something that be considered going forward. I note that it provides protection to both the company and the commission, and that to the extent that this is done properly, it ensures that the decision that results from it is less subject to challenge. And it also gives developers a fair opportunity to submit a real proposal. Those are my additional suggestions, Mr. Groom.
Thank you, Mr. Hahn. Subject to redirect, Your Honor, I have no further questions.
Is Jeff Kotsacko? Oh, I'm sorry. In the groove, Mr. Koontz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Hahn, let me see if we can start at some areas of agreement. If I understand your summary and your testimony, there seems to be agreement between your review and the company's testimony that the company will have a capacity deficit of about 149 megawatts in 2015. Is that correct?
That's correct.
In your testimony, you stated that your recommendation that the ADP and certificates of PC&N be denied because the company has not selected the least cost alternative. But then I thought I saw a little bit of room in your summary. Would you agree with me, Mr. Hahn, and having reviewed the ADP statutes, there is nothing in the ADP statute that requires a resource alternative to be the least cost in order to be determined prudent. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that the statute appears to be silent on that issue, so it neither precludes it nor specifically demands it.
And likewise,
and as I said earlier, I believe that it's an issue that's certainly ripe for consideration.
And likewise, with respect to our certificates of public convenience necessity chapters, both 03 and 03.1 of Chapter 49 or Title 49, none of those statutes refer to lease costs, do they?
No, they don't, sir.
And let me, would you agree with me that it might be possible that you might have more than one project that could be prudent for a utility?
I suppose that's theoretically possible, although I've never run across that.
Let me use
There's usually a preferred alternative, if you will, Mr. Kuntz, and if it's close to others, then that's fine.
Let me try to use a loose analogy, and the commission can decide how good of an analogy is. But let's say that I'm in the market for a new car, and I walk into my dealer and I say, you know, I really want what's your least cost vehicle here, and they point me to this little subcompact that's got the best mileage, lowest sticker price, and said, here's your best deal. And that would, and if I said, you know, I think I'll pick that one. That would be could be considered a prudent decision on my part, couldn't it?
Could be.
But let's say that, you know, I'm kind of a taller guy, and I kind of think that, you know, a little bigger car might be a little safer. So I'd like the, you know, won't want the subcompact. I kind of want the middle of the line car. And based upon those considerations, even though that's not the least cost, that could still be a prudent decision for me, could it not?
Certainly could.
And let's say that then I think some more, and you know, I live in North Dakota, and historically we get snow and ice in North Dakota. And
really?
Once in a while, I like to carry some stuff around, you know. So instead of this mid-sized car, I think I'd like to get, you know, an SUV that I could drive. And that's a little more, it's more expensive than my subcompact, and it's more expensive than my midsize, but I think, you know, there's considerations here that I can get with this, I can't get with the other, and so I'm going to go with the SUV. So that could also be a prudent decision for me, could it not?
Based on the number of SUVs I've seen since I've been here, yes, sir.
And would you agree with me that different generation resources also have different attributes?
Well, they do, but they're a good deal more homogeneous than a Subaru Justy versus a Cadillac Escalade.
Well, some resources offer better capacity attributes. Others offer better energy attributes. Would you agree with that?
No. I mean, once you get qualified for capacity in MISO, either under today's market or in the future market, each planning resource credit or megawatt of unforce capacity is equal.
No, but if a wind provides better energy attributes than it does capacity, and likewise a gas combustion, simple cycle combustion turbine provides better attributes for capacity than it does for energy production, would you agree? If I had a primary need for energy more so than capacity, I might be more focused on the wind. Whereas my primary need was capacity, I might be more focused on the combustion turbine.
I don't know that that's the case. I mean, there are differences in generation technology. Wind is an intermittent resource, and relative to its nameplate, the amount of unforced capacity credit that it's going to get is going to be relatively low.
But its fuel costs are considerably less.
Its fuel costs are considerably less, but the energy that it delivers to the grid has the same value as energy from a coal plant. It's valued at the LMP.
And would you agree with me that some pieces of equipment might be more reliable than other types of equipment?
I will grant you that's certainly possible, sure. But again, in the MISO construct, that's taken care of by unforced capacity. So if I have 200 megawatt resources and one has I'll just make the math simple. If one has a forced outage rate of 5%, then it gets 95 megawatts. Another 100 megawatt resource that has a 10% forced outage rate only gets 90. But each megawatt of unforced capacity is equal.
But in light of that consideration, might affect what I'm willing to pay for one versus the other.
Well, you're only going to pay for unforced capacity because that's all you get in capacity credit for.
I have two pieces of equipment sitting side by side, and one's got a little bit higher rate than the other. I might be willing to pay more for one than the other?
You will pay for unforced capacity. So whatever that price is divided by the unforced capacity, that's what you'll pay.
No, but if I've got two pieces of equipment, both of them are priced at $1 million. One's got a higher unforced capacity rate than the other. Which am I going to pick?
If capacity were your only criteria, and if your example were precisely what was proffered up in the marketplace, then obviously you'd pick the one with the lower forced outage rate.
So that might be a little bit more valuable to me than the other.
Right, but I guess my point is that chances are that lower availability is going to be reflected in the price, so it's unlikely you're going to get one resource for $1 million, if that was your number, that had radically different E4s. I just don't think that would happen.
Might also the location of where that resource is also improve the reliability on my system?
It could.
Would you agree with me as a general rule, the closer the generation source is to load, the more reliable that makes your system?
Not necessarily.
You don't agree with that from an engineering standpoint?
Nope.
So that you could have a resource that's 500 miles away that's serving your load, that's all connected by transmission, that is the same reliability in your mind as a resource that's located right next to that load?
I didn't say it was the same. Let me try it this way. If I have a resource that's some distance away, but it's connected by many 500 kV, 345 kV, 230 kV, and 115 kV systems, then I'm not too worried about deliverability. If, on the other hand, I have a local resource that has a radial line, for example, a single radial line, that may be less reliable than the resource that you're purchasing from far away. And so the point I tried to make previously is that you can analyze these things by doing reliability analyses, and I didn't see that that was done in this case.
But again, using our example, if we've got a resource that's a mile away from the load with a radial line and one that's 200 miles away with a radial line, which would you tend to, as a general sense, tend to think is more going to be more reliable?
In your example, obviously the shorter line, but I have to point out that I don't know of too many 200-mile radial lines. So I'm not sure that's a realistic example, but in your example, as you've presented it to me, with a 1 mile radial line connecting a single generator versus a 200-mile radial line, then the shorter radial line would be more reliable.
The closer you are to your load would tend to make that less likely to be interrupted.
But only under the assumptions that are in that question, which I'm not so sure I'd agree to.
Did you hear Ms. Stomberg's testimony this morning describing the incident that we had about a month ago because of an outage out at Heskett?
I heard reference to something about both Heskett units being out. I'm not sure I understood the complete scope of the reliability from that testimony, but I did hear what she said this morning.
So you had no reason to disagree with her description how the location of this CT out at Heskett at that time would have reduced the risk of outages in the Bismarck-Mandan area?
I have no reason to agree or disagree because the company hasn't done a study of the reliability in that area.
Are you telling me that the Vice President of Electric Supply at Montana Dakota wouldn't adequately be knowledgeable in terms of whether she thought that would improve reliability for that system?
I don't know Ms. Stomberg personally, but I'm sure she's highly qualified and a very smart person. But you're asking me to accept a fairly complicated premise or conclusion based on her 3 minutes of testimony on the subject here today. So I can't know. I mean, she might be right, but in most proceedings that I'm familiar with, companies and applicants don't just make statements like that. They have to support them somehow, and that's all I'm suggesting.
And you don't believe her description this morning was supportive?
I thought it was a little too brief to really know. It was interesting information, but the details of the circumstance weren't provided. I just don't know. I mean, as I said, I have great respect for Ms. Stomberg, and she could be right.
The other, in doing our comparison of what may be prudent resources between generation resources, they might have different environmental attributes, might they not? That might make you pick one resource over another, even though the other might be cheaper.
You could, in some circumstances, attribute a social cost of emissions. I don't believe that's the practice here in North Dakota, but in other jurisdictions, Mr. Kuntz, coal generation is assigned an additional cost for emitting nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and carbon dioxide. So it is possible, sir.
But that would be a situation, again, where you might have a least cost resources that prudent, but then when you consider the environmental attributes of another resource, you might determine that one's also prudent.
Well, but the cost of those, if the cost of those environmental attributes are included, then they'll be reflected in whether one is least cost or not.
Assuming that they've got quantifiable costs.
Sure. Sure.
Let me talk briefly about the North Dakota Wind Project, and I think we can move off of that fairly quickly. You would agree with me that even if the company or the commission agreed with your analysis that the 150-megawatt North Dakota Wind Project were built, that would not remove the company's need for additional capacity in 2015, would it?
I sincerely doubt it. I believe Mr. Nigam testified here today that that was an energy-only resource. If that's true, then there would be no capacity value from that plant. On the other hand, wind projects do provide capacity. And let's just say for the sake of argument that the resource was assigned a 15% level of its nameplate. So of the 150 megawatts, whatever 15% of 150 is, if it's 22.5, that's how much capacity they would get. Clearly, that would not solve a capacity need in 2015 of something close to 150, if that's the answer you were looking for, sir.
So this wind project would not necessarily make the 88-megawatt CT project imprudent as an alternative?
I offered no conclusion regarding that. No, in fact, I said we can defer the debate over the 150-megawatt wind project to someday after tomorrow.
Well, that's why I wanted to make clear that we were clear, that you weren't suggesting that as a reason to deny this particular application.
No, sir. I'm not using the availability of the North Dakota wind as a basis for my testimony. I'm using the availability of a purchase from Illinois.
In fact, are you aware that less than a year ago, the staff's consultant took the position that it was imprudent for the company to have built its existing 50 megawatts of wind generation?
I wasn't party to that case, sir, so I don't know.
Now let's talk about the Illinois proposal, because I think that's really where this case comes down to. You're aware the company did not pursue the Illinois proposal because of its concerns about the ability to use that capacity.
The company has stated that. Yes, I'm aware of that.
And I believe even you stated in your testimony that there is some risk that Montana Dakota might not be able to utilize the capacity from the Illinois proposal in the MDU's capacity zone.
I believe that's a small to zero risk, but yes, it's theoretically possible.
And if I understand correctly, under the current MISO adequacy resource construct, if approved, there would be an annual capacity auction within the various MISO capacity zones.
There would.
Understanding?
There would.
And under the MISO proposal, MDU would not receive PRCs, planning resource credits, I believe they are, for its Zone 1 demand from the Illinois proposal.
I must not have heard that question right. Could you repeat that?
Under the MISO proposal, Montana Dakota would not necessarily receive PRCs for its Zone 1 demand as a result of the power purchase agreement from the Illinois proposal.
I don't agree with that.
And so it's your position that if it bought this Illinois proposal, it would receive 176 or 88 megawatts, whatever size of PPA, of Zone 1 PRCs?
I believe that is a possible outcome under the proposed regulatory resource adequacy plan under MISO.
And in order to receive those credits in Zone 1, isn't it true that the company would have to secure a transmission service request?
I don't know that to be the case, sir.
You don't know that to be the case?
I don't.
You heard Mr. Nigam testify, I believe, this morning, that in order to reassure itself that it could use those credits in Zone 1, it would have to secure a TSR.
I heard him say that, yes, sir.
You don't know if that's correct or not?
I don't agree with that.
Do you have something to cite from MISO's proposal that would indicate the company would get credit for those that capacity in Zone 4 to meet its Zone 1 demands?
Right. I get that question. I don't know, as I sit here, that I can cite you chapter and verse of the MISO proposed tariff, but at a high level, it's my understanding that, as I said earlier, power flows from the west to the east in MISO. And so delivering power from Illinois to North Dakota runs counter to that. And so, to me, there's no deliverability issues with that.
Are you aware that general statement that power flows west to east applies for baseload and renewable energy, not necessarily for peak?
I think in the MISO transmission expansion plan, they refer to Illinois as a import constrained zone at the time of the peak.
Were you aware that North Dakota is a net importer on peak?
I believe I don't know that, because they show energy being imported from MISO, but in Aegeus it doesn't tell me when it is.
So if North Dakota were a net importer on peak, which is when MISO determines your PRCs, not...
That part is correct, yes.
If North Dakota were a net importer, can you necessarily assume that you will be able to use those capacity credits from that Illinois resources to meet your Zone 1 demand?
Well, again, I think it depends on the deliverability of the system. And so to the extent that a study was done to either show that at the time of the peak there's no available capacity on the MDU transmission system, that would be helpful in answering that question. But I haven't seen that analysis.
And even if it was deliverable, do you agree with Mr. Nigam that there would be a charge for the use of that deliverability from Zone 4 to Zone 1?
No, I do not.
And do you have any source for that disagreement?
Well, again, it's if you read the MISO filing, there is a lot of discussion about continuing the robustness of the bilateral market, and to continue to be using existing contracts. So I think if this had been signed in 2010, which would have been before the grandmother date, then it's certainly possible that they would not pay.
You heard Mr. Nigam that use of that grandmothered agreement would require that TSR be in place as well.
Again, I heard him say that.
Mr. Hahn, I'm curious. I mean, it's pretty clear from early on, both from your testimony and the company's rebuttal, that the ability to use the credits from this Illinois proposal were a key issue in this case. Would you agree that you had raised?
Absolutely.
You're somewhat critical in saying that, the company could have done this better, the company could have done that better, the company didn't show me this. I would have thought you would come here with line and verse for the MISO proposal to assure this commission that if the company had purchased or does purchase those Illinois power purchase agreement, it was going to be able to use those credits fully in Zone 1. Can you point to me, line and verse, anything that you've provided from the MISO proposal to show that the company will be able to use those credits in Zone 1?
As I said, Mr. Kuntz, I cannot do that as I sit here.
And so do we have a situation where the company could theoretically buy credits in Illinois and not be able to use them in its service territory in North Dakota?
As I indicated, I think that is a theoretical possibility, but given my knowledge of the MISO filing and the review that I undertook, I don't know how. It's certainly not a certainty.
And that theoretical possibility is that your position, the company would be allowed to recover the cost of that power purchase agreement, even though those credits weren't able to be used to serve customers in North Dakota.
I didn't analyze the rate-making treatment for this unit, so I don't know the answer to that.
And we could have a situation where the company would be paying for credits in Illinois and at the same time having to buy credits in the MISO market in Zone 1, not?
I'll grant you that's a theoretical possibility, but again, as I said earlier, it's my belief that prices will be higher in Illinois because of the import-constrained nature of that area, so it might actually turn out to be a benefit if the scenario that you hypothesized came to be true.
Let's take that scenario. I mean, there's one scenario is somehow under the MISO construct, the company would be able to utilize those Illinois credits fully in its Zone 1 through a transmission service request or maybe a modification of the rules. The other possibility, as I understand from your testimony and talking to Mr. Nigam, is that you buy capacity in Zone 1, sell your capacity in Zone 4, and hopefully the prices are about the same, so you've netted them out and customers, in essence, indirectly have the benefit of that credit that you sold in Illinois without having to pay for transmission between the zones. Is that also a possibility?
Again, I think that's a theoretical possibility, yes.
Is that what you're suggesting here? Rather than if the company can't secure transmission between Zone 1 and Zone 4, I thought from your testimony that's kind of what you were suggesting. Use the Illinois credits as kind of a hedge against what you're going to have to pay for credits in Zone 1.
Well, if it turns out that it's not deliverable from Illinois to Dakota, then that would still produce a beneficial outcome to customers. I'm not sure that it isn't deliverable. So, and if it is deliverable, then they will get the benefit in Zone 1.
And if it's not deliverable, then hopefully these prices between Zone 1 and Zone 4 will work out.
Well, I don't think it's a hope. I think the prices in Zone 4, I believe it's Zone 4 where the Illinois unit is located, I believe they're going to be higher than the prices in Zone 1.
In that scenario, in essence, Montana Dakota would be an independent power producer in Zone 4, wouldn't they, for all practical purposes? They're bidding in that contract they've got into the market and hoping that they can get more from the market than what they're paying Tilton for it.
I would not agree with the characterization independent power producer. They would be a vertically integrated utility with a resource in a different capacity zone than some of their load.
And they would be bid into a different capacity zone.
Again, that is a possibility, sir.
Might we not accomplish the same thing by doing a PPA with in Florida and bid in Florida?
Well, no, because Florida is not a part of MISO.
Well, it doesn't have to be a part of MISO. If we've got a good contract in Florida with a PPA, we could sell in the Florida market and offset the cost of bidding into North Dakota, couldn't we?
No, I don't agree with that.
I asked Mr. Nigam this morning whether he was, or this afternoon, if he was aware of how MISO would treat a situation where if there was a capacity deficit in a particular zone. The company had to pay penalties, but there was still a deficit for its zone. How it would handle that deficit in the event that capacity in that zone wasn't sufficient to meet demand. Do you have an understanding from the MISO filing of how that will be handled?
Well, if you're talking about a physical shortage in an import-constrained area, I mean, I believe the laws of physics say that if your transmission lines won't import it and you don't have it inside, then something has to happen. Either load has to go down or you've got to find some other generation to turn on.
Do you know from the MISO proposal of how they've proposed to meet that? I mean, through this auction doesn't create generation in itself. So how do you meet a deficit situation through this auction proposal?
In any power system, whether you have a capacity market or not, or whether you have vertically integrated utilities being responsible for their own capacity, there is always a possibility of an outage of enough pieces of equipment that you will not be able to serve load. I don't believe that's unique to a capacity market, to a system that has a formal capacity market. And so that's why it's important to do the kind of reliability assessments that I referenced earlier. That's why NERC, National Electric Reliability Corporation, requires transmission owners to do a 1, 5, and 10-year evaluation of the system to try and make sure, to the extent, maximum extent possible, that doesn't happen.
So you're not citing me to anything, so I take it you're not aware of anything specifically in the MISO proposal for their auction of how they would address an overall shortage in planning credits.
No, it wouldn't be there because the MISO capacity construct, if you will, is an attempt to encourage capacity where it's needed. That's why in an import-constrained area you have higher prices, and the higher prices are intended to encourage the construction of new capacity. The reliability problems that you're referring to are ones that operators face once the system is built. So however you built that system, whether you built it through a formal capacity market or whether you had individual utilities, you know, operating as islands and doing their own thing, you always have a concern about an incident or a series of incidents that could cause you to be unable to serve load. So I would not expect the MISO capacity market to address a physical shortage, if you will. That's an operating issue, whereas the MISO reliability contract is a planning issue.
And even this is an annual auction, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
So if in the end of 2013, the company bids into its 2014 needs and it's not able to acquire sufficient capacity credits through that auction, what's going to happen?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, let's assume that in 2014, let's go 2015. That's the company's current contract expires. It's got a need for 150 planning credits. It bids into the auction, and it can't. There aren't enough credits in the auction to satisfy everybody who's short. The company can only get 130 credits out of that auction. What happens?
They import 20.
Well, assuming it's import constrained.
Okay, then if you've built a system and now you're trying to operate it, and if as a result, I mean, first of all, your question does not address the issue of whether this is a situation with all facilities in service or with one or two facilities out, which is the normal reliability planning standard. But again, it's a physical operating problem. I mean, if you don't have the ability, if you are in an import-constrained area and the in-zone generation plus the import capability is not greater than the load, then you have to do something.
And would you agree with Mr. Nigam's testimony that under the MISO proposal, to the extent the company didn't acquire sufficient planning credits, it would be subject to penalties based upon the cone or some multiple of the cone?
There is such a penalty provision in the MISO construct as it's been filed.
And would it be your position that if the company were not able to use the Illinois credits to meet its Zone 1 requirements and weren't able to acquire sufficient credits in the Zone 1 auction that it incurred penalties, that those penalties would then be recoverable from customers?
I again, didn't address the issue of recoverability. I did a cost comparison, but I did not make any specific analysis or assumptions about cost recovery for any of this.
Shouldn't the cost of these risks somehow been included in your analysis in some manner? I mean, if there was a transmission cost to get those credits from Zone 4 to Zone 1, or there was a risk that you might not be able to fully recover those, whether it's 5 or 10%, shouldn't that somehow you have attempted to quantify that in the same way that you say the company should have attempted to quantify the reliability value of locating that generator in North Dakota?
In an ideal world, it would have been nice to do the reliability analysis that I referenced. That was not the scope of my assignment. I don't have all the resources available to me that the company has. In my experience, other transmission owners do these studies on a routine basis. So my only point is that this issue didn't appear to be mentioned anywhere in either the company's IRP or in the case. In fact, the company has a 10-year transmission planning document that, you know, quite frankly, seems to imply that everything's fine. So I was a little bit surprised to find out that there's now the possibility, at least, of some of these additional costs. And the point I'm trying to make is that if these issues were as prominent as they now appear to be, seems to me that they should have been analyzed in the RFP and the IRP.
I think we're talking two separate things. I'm talking the risk of not being able to use the Illinois credits, that there should be some quantification of that risk applied to your cost comparison between the on-system owned unit versus the Zone 4 proposal.
Well, you could. I mean, to the extent that the amount to be paid had a probability associated with it, you could quantify it.
And
sure.
You didn't attempt to do that.
No, sir.
And well, with respect to the reliability, you can have two units, the location of which may be both located in North Dakota, one close to a load center, one not close to a load center. One might incrementally improve your reliability. The other doesn't do anything for reliability. I mean, that's a consideration. It may not have a significant cost benefit associated with, but it's a consideration that you as a system planner would consider, would you not?
I'd love the opportunity to consider that.
You also recognize, I believe, in your testimony that the company's ability to utilize the Illinois capacity could be affected if MDU were no longer a member of MISO.
Can you point me to a site for that?
You believe? Well, let me ask you this question. Do you believe the company's ability to utilize the Illinois capacity could be affected if MDU were no longer a member of MISO?
Not necessarily. When a member decides to leave an RTO like MISO, and in MISO's case, there's a 5-year notice. I believe there's an exit fee, but I'm not 100% sure of that. And what generally happens is that if they want to leave, they're not allowed to, quote unquote, strand transmission customers. And I think a good example of this is another project that I've been involved in is Entergy Arkansas wanted to join MISO. They are connected through a single 345 kV transmission line that goes through Ameren. And the other alternative was that they join SPP, Southwest Power Pool, which Entergy has dozens of connections. And so during the proceeding, the folks from MISO were asked to describe, you know, what would happen if Ameren left. And what the folks from MISO said was, well, you know, there is this exit fee, there is a five-year notice period, and that it's FERC's policy not to allow transmission, other transmission customers to be harmed by that decision. And they actually use the word hold harmless. So, you know, obviously, if MDU left, but there were still other transmission ties, maybe they wouldn't have to be concerned about that. But I don't think that FERC will allow a system, an RTO, that was built on an integrated system to allow a key member in the middle of it to exit and leave another transmission customer stranded. I don't think that's likely.
Are you aware that both MDU and RTO over the last 3 years have given notice of possible consideration to exit MISO?
I was informed that a couple of years ago Ottertail made such a statement.
Are you aware that MDU has also made such a notice?
I don't recall that, but certainly a possibility.
And you're aware, I assume, through the testimony today of the numerous interconnections that Montana Dakota has with the IS system.
The WAPA system, yes, they were described in a map that Mr. Nigam showed.
So because of considerations which might be happening at MISO, at some set point maybe it would make sense for Montana Dakota to join the ISO and leave MISO. In that event, are you suggesting there would not be a charge for its ability to use those Illinois credits?
I'm sorry, what ISO are they joining?
The WAPA ISO with Basin and WAPA.
You know, I'm not familiar with that, but I think your question is, would they still be able to use the combustion turbine in Illinois if they left MISO and joined an RTO that or an ISO that involved WAPA and Basin Electric? Is that the question? Or any other ISO. Well, I'm not sure what other alternative there would be, but... I don't know the answer to that. It's possible that they might need to treat this resource as an external, when I say this resource, the resource in Illinois, as an external resource. Without knowing what that transmission tariff of the merged companies, I couldn't say for sure what that would be. I'm not aware that the company has any serious plans, nor have they filed notice to withdraw from ISO, so I don't know. Lots of possibilities.
And, you know, a lot of the possibilities we've discussed this afternoon, Mr. Hahn, revolve around this MISO resource adequately construct as proposed.
Well, we've certainly talked about that. I don't know. I'm not sure I can link that to the possibility of people leaving MISO.
No, but not leaving MISO necessarily, but the ability to use how you might use credits in Illinois to serve load in North Dakota, the annual auction, all of those are kind of tied to this MISO construct proposal.
Well, if you're not in MISO, you're not going to participate in the MISO capacity market.
No, but I mean the auction process and how we might be utilizing the different Zone 1 and Zone 4, those are all things that are part of this MISO proposal, the annual capacity auction, these zones, these load-serving zones, those are all part of that MISO proposal, are they not?
Well, the various capacity zones are part of the resource adequacy construct, yes, sir.
And that construct hasn't even been approved yet, has it?
No, sir, it hasn't.
And there's been a number of critical comments filed to that proposal, haven't there?
They most certainly have.
And including comments by the Organization of MISO States.
They've been a heard party in this case, yes.
In which this commission is a member of.
Yes, they are.
So we don't even know how that construct, if and when it's approved, what it's going to look like, do we?
Well, obviously you don't have final approval yet, but on the other hand, the current filing was done. I mean, this isn't the first time this issue has arisen. I mean, it's been filed before, and FERC's ordered them to do things. So, I mean, I suppose the entire concept could be scrapped and they start over again, but that seems unlikely.
But doesn't it seem somewhat risky to you that the company would file or sign an 88-megawatt PPA based upon the utilization in the construct that hasn't been approved, or that if it's approved could then be changed in 3 to 5 years from now in terms of its ability to use those resources?
Well, I think no matter what gets finally approved, it can always change in the future. I mean, you went from the system of what we have today to what you're going to have in 2 years. So there's always a risk. On the other hand, you know, you look at the – you have to look at the benefit side as well. I mean, how much money would you save if you were able to use this? And that's really all the point I'm trying to make.
In your exhibits 7 and 9, you included carrying costs based upon MDU's embedded cost of debt. Is that correct?
Well, I used the interest rate that the company used. I don't believe it was advertised or described as embedded cost prior to the the revised exhibit of Mr. Nigam.
You don't recall what that cost of debt was?
That was 7%.
And then you filed your revised exhibit 7 and 9 after he filed his corrected testimony, pointing out that the current cost of debt would be between 4 and 4.5%, correct?
But that's what his testimony is, yes, sir.
You didn't bother to correct the carrying cost for your exhibit, though?
No, sir.
Would you agree that 4, 4.5% is more representative of the cost of financing this project?
I have not looked at what the company's cost of debt. I assume the company knew its cost of debt when it put the filing in, so I stuck with it.
Are you familiar with it?
Just if I could, I continued to rely on the 7%.
Notwithstanding Mr. Nigam's subsequent testimony saying the cost of financing this project is closer to 4 to 4.5.
That's right. I continue to use 7%.
You also showed in your Exhibit 9 that there was a cost advantage to Illinois proposal based upon congestion benefits, assuming higher energy prices in Zone 4. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's based upon 1 year of historical data. Is that not correct?
Exhibit RSH 8 shows the most recent 12 months. And in particular, if you look at the on-peak, this is a graph of on-peak LMPs. So that was the basis of the assumed $10 per megawatt hour price difference between Illinois and the Heskett zone, which is the Montana-Dakota price node we looked at.
Your exhibit then takes, based upon 1 year of historical data, then projects that forward for the next 20.
Yes.
Same price difference.
Yes. Well, now we didn't escalate that price difference either. I mean, I held it flat at $10 a megawatt hour. I mean, while other fuel costs are escalating. So, you know, there's a sort of a degree of conservatism, if you will, in that we've not escalated those congestion costs. As LMPs would be expected to rise, you might expect that difference to rise, but I didn't include that.
Well, you testified that you thought some of these MVP projects would improve congestion between the zones to make improve the ability of the company to utilize that Illinois capacity, did you not?
Absolutely, and I believe that those projects will reduce congestion, which is why I've held that figure flat. I did not allow it to grow.
Well, actually, shouldn't it reduce that gap over time?
I suppose that's possible. I will note that that's a $3.9 million net present value out of 59, so I'm not sure if it were declining that it would change the final conclusion very much. But I will grant you, Mr. Kuntz, that it is possible that congestion could decline.
And I was somewhat unclear regarding the WAPA transmission charge that Mr. Nigam described. You're not saying you don't believe that transmission charge can be avoided with the 88-megawatt combustion turbine in Heskett. You're just uncertain. Is that correct?
Well, you said you were confused, and I'll admit that I'm confused because, again, in a call we had with the company that was attributable to what I refer to as loop flow. And now I find here today that it's attributable to an offset for network service, which makes me equally confused because network service is paid for by load. It's not dependent on how much generation you have. So I'm not sure what the company really meant by that.
In that call that you had with staff, did Mr. Nigam, in describing the WAPA charge, anywhere refer to that charge being attributable to loop flow, or was that just your assumption from the fact that there was a WAPA charge?
I think the word loop flow came up in the call, but it, if Mr. Nigam didn't say it, then you can attribute that interpretation to me.
And did you ask for any additional information from the time Mr. Nigam filed his rebuttal testimony until today, requesting further information regarding this WAPA charge?
No, sir.
And would you agree with me, Mr. Hahn, that really that's a pretty critical piece to evaluating, in addition to how whether we're going to be able to use these Illinois credits, in terms of a cost comparison, that WAPA charge is a pretty critical piece in your analysis, whether or not it exists or doesn't exist?
Well, it's a critical piece in Mr. Nigam's analysis, too. And as I said in my opening remarks, it's a big number. And so I think we clearly need to get to the bottom of it.
And you're aware, I believe you referenced the fact that the North Dakota ADP statute requires the commission to consider the benefits of having a generation facility located in this state when reviewing an ADP application, correct?
It's my understanding that in-state resources are afforded a presumption of prudence.
And also requires specifically the commission to consider the benefits of locating the resource in North Dakota.
This is the ADP statute?
That's correct.
I don't have a copy of that with me. I'll accept that that language is there. I don't have a copy with me to verify it.
Did you give any consideration to comparative benefits of having the resource located in North Dakota?
Well, to the extent that in the carrying charges there were property taxes included, that would be a benefit. So we have included that.
Deduct?
No.
Well, you're supposed to consider the benefits. So the extent property taxes are paid in North Dakota, isn't that a benefit of locating a project in North Dakota versus the Illinois?
Could be. Yes, you're right.
And what about income taxes that would be paid to any of the states that Montana, Dakota serves?
Well, again, I...
income tax.
Sorry. No.
You didn't consider that?
No.
That would be a benefit, though, to those states.
Could count that as a benefit.
And increased jobs associated with having the project located here versus Illinois? You consider that?
No, because it was my understanding that the company was going to use the existing staff at Heskett Station. That was one of the benefits they cited.
Well, the benefits is reduced staff, but there would still be a need for two additional positions, if you heard Mrs. Stomberg testify.
Again, I heard that today for the first time.
That's all the questions I have of Mr. Hahn.
Now, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Well, one of the things that staff is requesting is whether advocacy staff would be able to produce a similar list to what we requested of MDU, which would be your understanding of the non or unquantified factors that MDU used in supporting its request for ADP. We had asked for the same thing from MDU, but we wanted to know if advocacy staff had the same list of what were the unquantified considerations or factors. You wouldn't have to do it from the witness stand, but
that'd
whether
be very,
you could
very nice
produce
of you.
It as a late filed exhibit.
That's something I think I need to talk to Mr. Grumman about. Quite frankly, that's not a question that I did anticipate. So the question would be for us, me, to list the non-quantifiable factors?
Well, considerations or factors, yes, because we've had a lot of testimony of all the factors that go into the decision, some of which are quantified, for example, in the IRP. and then there are some that cannot be quantified. And we're trying to find out if the parties have the same list or have a different idea of what those are.
Well, if you put that as a request to me, I will do the best job I can answering it with Mr. Grumman's assistance. I don't think I could do it today, though.
I understand
that. Okay. I want to be clear about that.
And it would be the same name as the previous late or MDU exhibit, but it would be advocacy staffs.
So let me understand what the title of this is. It's a non-quantifiable list of non-quantifiable factors or considerations, what, for the...
That MDU used to support or to rely, for its application for ADP.
So you want me to come up with a list of factors that,
that you understand that they used, yes.
Ah, okay, that's a... Thank you for that.
Which I'm... I guess... I'm sorry if it's so confusing, but I'm guessing that your analysis of their application, you had to say, this is quantified, this isn't. I don't know. But if you have such a list or if you can produce such a list, would you be willing to submit it?
As I said, I will give it my good old college try.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Grumman? Is there an, I'm asking.
I'm
for
not
going
to agree to anything right now, but we'll talk about it and then we'll get back. I mean, it's, I think it's the best we can do at this point. There's a request that's made, but we need to get our head wrapped around exactly what's being requested. So that's about the only answer that I have at this moment. If that's an objection, I guess it's an objection.
Let me think about this, Mr. Kuntz.
It's. Doesn't come to me. I guess, I mean, I think if it's a request for factors that we considered in our decision-making process, which I think is what we were asked to do, non-quantifiable factors, I think we'll try to develop that list.
Theirs is already agreed.
Personally, it's probably a little bit unfair to ask Mr. Hahn to come up with a list based upon his understanding.
No, I don't. Don't misunderstand me. I'm asking for an objection. You've got an exhibit that is going to go into evidence. Do you have an objection to doing this?
It's his understanding of what we considered, I guess.
Well, yes or no?
No.
All right. That's what I'm looking for. So, Mr. Grumman, back to you. This is not something you're supposed to think about this now.
I can't give you a definitive yes, so therefore, by logic, I have to say no. I mean, I think that's pretty much what's been expressed.
You have no objection.
No, I mean, that I do have an objection.
Well, that's not going to work, Mr. Grumman. You have a choice.
I object
or I do not object.
I object. Because we're not even sure exactly what's being asked of us.
I agree. Or what you're going to put together, or what it's going to look like.
Exactly.
This is a little bit different from what I, you know, this business about, let me just editorialize a little bit on my way out the door. These late-filed exhibits, they continue to grow and expand way beyond, I think, what they started out years ago when I first started this. And what we're doing is we're putting evidence into the record that nobody's seen. Nobody's had a chance to evaluate it. And I think that's a problem. Now, Mr. Grumman has a point. He's looking at me. He says, what am I supposed to object to? I haven't seen anything. I don't even know if we can reasonably do this. So
may I?
I'm inclined to sustain the objection, but go ahead.
Well, all that we are trying to do was we have had testimony initially from the applicant that there are certain considerations that are not cannot be quantified, that are a basis for why they are asking for something. And they have agreed to provide that, which they've testified to it. All we're saying is don't make us search for them, please. At least put them down in one place for us. So that's applicants. All we were trying to get to then is whether or not advocacy staff even knew that the case had those considerations in it. Now, the second question might be, okay, what do you think about those considerations? But we're not that far here in order to ask that. That's all we were trying to ask from advocacy staff. So, if you sustain the objection, I understand that. The MDU question, that one's been admitted, so I don't know that there's any...
No, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
MDU agreed to do that.
Right.
It's no concern of mine generally speaking, if there's no objection, that's not my business to say there should be an objection.
Okay, I understand. We were just asking for the staff's analysis of that same list to see if it was the same or different. Staff's
out of curiosity,
question.
What are you going to do, Mr. Hahn? Are you going to review the record and see what the testimony was about these non-quantifiable factors, or how are you going to come up with this list?
With the clarification that I'm supposed, I thought the original question was to ask me what I thought the unquantifiable factors were.
I thought it was
the question that I now understand I'm being asked is for me to say what the company did,
right.
And what I would do is go through the company's filing and look and say, oh, here's a factor they mentioned. They haven't quantified it, or they've said it can't be quantified. I think, that's really the only way I could try to address that question.
Some of that is in the testimony already. You testified that reliability was one such.
Sure. And so
factor, unquantified. That's the kind of, and I'm not asking him to put words in the company's mouth or read their mind. I'm just asking his analysis of the company's justification that's not quantified that's what we're asking for. But
Mr. Grumman, you want to reconsider your objection?
No.
Objection.
All right.
The objection.
I can withdraw. I can withdraw
awesome.
Too.
The
I don't care.
The objection is sustained.
Okay.
Anything further, Mr.
No, Grumman? I don't. I don't have anything.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
I just have one, and it's related to the impact of potential retirements of the coal fleet in the MISO region. The MDU has submitted testimony in MDU 111 DJN1, which is the EPA impact analysis from the MISO. Discusses the fairly dramatic impact that MISO projects for itself, and probably more so than other RTOs around the country, of potentially up to 13 gigawatts of potential retirements. In fact, they indicate that they expect that it'll be towards that higher value of 13 gigawatts, given some other things. To what degree is that taken into your consideration of, how is it taken into consideration in your testimony?
Oh,
has it impacted at all?
I did not specifically I didn't analyze deliverability at all, and to the best of my knowledge, needed in the company. So even under the existing system, the deliverability analysis hasn't been done. So if the question is how would the retirement of all these units affect the deliverability, the answer is I don't know.
Okay. But it doesn't have any impact on your analysis of selecting a resource in a different zone.
On my analysis, no, sir.
Okay. Thanks. That's all I have.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks, Mr. Hahn. Won't give you any comfort to know that Mr. Kuntz asked most of the questions I was going to ask, but I do have a couple of sort of maybe clarifying issues. One is Mr. Grumman had asked a question or two of Ms. Stomberg, I guess it was, relating to the shareholder profit motive, I guess, for lack of a better, how much do we consider that as some sort of a suspicious motive or give weight? How do we give weight to that?
Well, I think you have to acknowledge that the company is in business to serve their shareholders, and they have a dual – I've been in their shoes,
mm-hmm.
So they have a dual responsibility to their customers to keep rates as low as possible and to keep service as good as possible, and they have an obligation to their shareholders who have invested money in the company. But, I mean, there is a tendency, if you're an investor-owned utility, to favor your own build projects, quite frankly, because they do increase rate base, and rate base is what you make your earnings for. I'm not saying that you should necessarily impute a penalty, but and by the way, if it were close, you know, maybe then the investment on behalf of the company would be the way to go. I was here 2 months ago in a different proceeding, and the conclusion was, yes, there is a lower cost alternative, but, you know, quite frankly, I'm not sure it's better than what the company has proposed, and the costs were close. So I recommended going with the investment option in the Black Big Stone AQCS. Now, on the other hand, if you have a situation where there's a big difference, then I think you have to, you know, think about that. So I think the line of questioning was intended to point out that there is a benefit to the company from picking its own resources, but I don't know that there's necessarily a dollar penalty to be associated with that.
Okay. Then just one other sort of analytical question. Do you think that the stage is being set for whether it's a combined cycle or a second CT or something bigger than this single 88 megawatt, highly dispatchable, but 88 megawatt turbine in Mandan? Is that stage being set? Is that obvious? Am I right to be, suspicious of that? Because quite honestly, if that is the case, and if a couple of years from, after this is built, obviously the next one becomes a little harder for advocates who might have a concern to oppose. And so am I right to be somewhat concerned?
Well, it certainly appears to me that the stage is being set to take this 88 megawatt combustion turbine and convert it to combined cycle operation, either through the installation of a heat recovery steam generator and a new steam turbine, or a heat recovery steam generator and the two existing steam turbines that are at Heskett. It does appear to me that that's the case. And yet, that option was never picked in the resource plan. I am a little bit confused by that. And it will be interesting, I think, to see if the company does go out for an RFP in 2012, what its proposed project is. Because if it turns out to be combined cycle operation, then one would have to look back at this proceeding and say, where was that? So, I think it certainly looks to me like the stage has been set. I can't testify to motive. I don't know what the company's plans are, but that would certainly be look like an option that's being set up.
Okay. Nothing else. Thank you.
Further questions for the commissioner? Commissioner Cox.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hahn.
You're welcome, sir.
The proposals that you looked at, can you give me some more background on the one that was, for lack of a better term, rejected about the wind and nuclear resource? I mean, how did you go through and you got – I'm sure you looked at all these different proposals in the RFP.
It was just a wind project. It was a North Dakota wind project.
There's one that's in Mr. Nygum's PowerPoint that says a wind and or nuclear resource. Is that not correct?
I didn't look at a nuclear resource.
Okay. I guess I was just trying to go through a little, as you went through them, what was the next best one if you take out the Illinois project?
Well, it appears that the what's referred to as the North Dakota wind project, I won't name it because that's confidential, but it was a 150-megawatt proposal.
That's the one we talked
about.
The
company rejected that because MISO had issued a cost estimate of, and I think the number is $191 million or $190 million that you would have to add in terms of transmission upgrades to interconnect that project with the grid. And then there was a subsequent analysis that dropped that to 25. And so with that drop in quote-unquote transmission cost, that alternative produced a fair amount of benefits in the Aegeus run.
So how far down the list would you have to go to put this project that the company is proposing right now?
I'm sorry, I don't have that list. Could I borrow Mr. Grumman's exhibit book?
I may approach.
You may.
Thank
Because there was numerous alternatives the request for proposal came back with.
Yes.
And I'm just curious how far down the list you'd put this project that the company is putting forward today. If you have anything on that, I mean, how you I would guess you weighted them all to some degree.
Well, we did, but again, what we were looking at, and as I said earlier, we'll defer a debate on the wind project.
So you were looking for the best one, in your opinion, not trying to rank them, if
right,
you will.
Right, right. And it, the funny thing about the Illinois proposal is that if you just – there was a form they filled out, and it had prices. And if you looked at those prices, you would know that that project would be cheaper than a new build. And so, it immediately drew our attention. It said, we should look at this. And now you've seen what's happened and all the issues that have come up since then. But the reason why we picked that is that it was really so attractive on the terms that it was offered up that you had to look at it.
Probably a plant out there that has lost its markets because there's no longer the demand out there, something like that. But I guess what I'm trying to get a feel for, though, is you said something that I talked to Mr. Nigel about the request for proposal. I can't remember your exact words, but you said it wasn't done very well. That's what I heard you say.
Well, I
think it could have been done better.
The concern I have is that you had a project that was extremely attractive price-wise, and yet it wasn't selected.
But that didn't. So did that have to do with the proposal itself or their interpretation of the projects as they came back?
Well, it had to do with the RFP process. I mean, let's face it. If the commission were to set a policy, and I'm not saying they have and I'm not saying they should, but if you want to have a policy to have only in-state resources, then it's your next RFP. Tell those folks from Illinois they need not apply. I think that you should look at other resources because when I was here before, there was great pride taken in the fact that North Dakota has lowest electric rates in the country. And I think as long as you continue to keep least cost feasible resource in your sort of mindset, there's a good chance that position will continue.
So in your experience and what you do, if a proposal was written that said that generation must be in zone one of MISO, would that be a legitimate point in a request for proposal? Would that be something that you think would not be appropriate?
Well, you could do that, and yet that will limit the bid you'll get. So you have to decide, and maybe the company makes this decision when they submit, or I don't even know if they do submit their next RFP and the commission approves it, but you have to decide, gee, if I'm only going to consider resources in zone one, LRC zone one, you have to ask yourself, what am I excluding? Is there a project out there that would produce greater benefits? So, I will tell you what other jurisdictions have done. They've gone for a broad approach, and then they've done a deliverability analysis. And that, at least you have some analytical basis on which to say, gee, that's a really good bid, but you know what? If you add all these other costs, and it doesn't make the cut.
So based on your experience in these kind of things, because one of the things I'll use an example of, we do land reclamation here too. We've gotten some bids from well outside the region that are very low. And when it comes time to do the project, they fall apart. So how much work do you do in your analysis that what they've actually said they can deliver from Illinois actually can be delivered, and it's not just something on a piece of paper that when the company goes through and does all the things, it doesn't work? How do we broker that?
Well, again, I think you do a deliverability analysis.
So now, when would that be done? After they've already decided they're going to do it? Should that
no,
be
you should do it as part of the RFP. The RFP, yes, absolutely.
Okay, because I guess I'm just trying to step back from a viewpoint of we have all this energy in the state, and I've heard all the testimony, but it's hard to fathom that all the variables of moving electricity from all the way across there to all the way here have been considered in this.
Well, I guess I'm not sure that they have, and I think they should be. And so,
Okay, but yet you're telling us that this is the best deal, but you just said to me they maybe haven't all been considered in their cost estimate.
Well, based on the information that was provided to us, it looked to us like this resource was deliverable. Now,
what do you think has not been considered in this? Because that's big.
Absolutely. And so to the extent that there is a deliverability analysis out there that says, no, this can't be delivered, my belief is that when you do that, you'll find that it is deliverable, because I believe that the wheeling from this project runs counterflow to the normal flow of
that discussion.
Okay. So you think the deliverability analysis is the biggest variable in what you've recommended at this point?
Yes.
Okay. I think that was it. Thank you.
Further questions from the commission? Mr. Grumman, follow up.
Mr. Hom, is there anything further you'd like to provide to the commission today that you haven't been asked?
I'd just like to thank the commission for the opportunity to work on this project and appear before you here today. Our assignment was to review the company's application and identify things that we agreed with and identify issues that we think should be addressed further. And I think we've done that. That's the only judgment of how effective we are. Obviously, it's up to the commission. Commission will make their decision based on the entire record. I don't live here in North Dakota. It seems like a really good place to live, especially compared to where I come from. And I don't pay an electric bill at Montana Dakota Utilities, and I don't live next door to the Heskett plant. So we tried to offer an objective analysis. Some of the issues that we've noticed company agrees with, there are some that they don't. But I think we've done the best job we can of trying to point out the issues, and I thank you for the opportunity to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Hahn. I have no further questions.
Mr. Kuntz.
Just one, Mr. Hahn, in response to Commissioner Kalk's question about whether the deliverability was the biggest variable here, did you neglect the WAPA transmission charges in that response?
Well, I included those in there, Mr. Kuntz. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear on that.
Nothing further, Mr. Kuntz?
No.
Jeff Kotsacko.
Dan took my question.
Follow-up. Any follow-up questions from the commission?
I do have just one.
Commissioner Clark.
We've talked about a deliverability analysis. I don't know if this is anywhere else in the record, but this would be an opportunity to supplement it. Could you describe exactly what is included in a deliverability analysis, or is this something that just within the community of planners is known exactly what that encompasses, or is it a loose term?
No, I can describe it for you. It's more often associated with new resources. So if someone says, I want to build a power plant here and I want to interconnect with the grid, utilities and organizations like MISO have procedures for studying whether that can be whether they can interconnect there without causing problems or overloads or voltage violations on the system. And so, the analysis that I described is something like that. You can look at the system and find out, hey, if I try to inject power in Illinois and withdraw it in Montana or in North Dakota, what would that do to the system? And can the system actually affect that transaction? And so it's done by analyzing the system using PowerFlow software. And
Okay, so these are the feasibility studies,
yes,
that MISO conducts.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And that's why when you ask for transmission service, that's what MISO does.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Grumman?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Kuntz? No. Ms. Jeff Kotsacko?
No.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Hahn.
It's always a pleasure, sir.
Looks like it.
Oh, it is. I mean it.
Madam Reporter, I know I'm pushing it, but just bear with me a bit. Anything further, Mr.
Grumman? Yes, a few questions for Darcy Nagum. So
yes, of course. You know, let's recess for 10 minutes. We've been at this quite a while, and for the rest of us, actually, 10 minutes until about 4:05. So,
did you read the same thing?
No,
I just saw that.
What was it?
The play.
Mr. Grumman, when you're ready.
FSC staff calls Darcy Nigam.
Mr. Nigam, you understand, of course, that your testimony continues under oath and subject to penalties of perjury.
Yes, I do.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have one question, Mr. Nigam. There's been a plethora of discussion today concerning WAPA IS costs. My question is whether or not MDU is promulgating any work papers in this regard concerning the WAPA IS costs and whether those have been submitted into the record.
We have not submitted any work papers into the record regarding that issue.
Have you promulgated any documents in that regard concerning the WAPA IS costs?
We have. As I said, or as I indicated earlier, we've done studies. The last study was as late as 2009 when we looked at the capabilities on the system as far as system intact and as far as in a contingency situation as far as being able to serve load, particularly in the Bismarck-Mandan area.
Well, Abdi's staff would then, I guess, request concerning a late filed exhibit whether or not that could be submitted into the record for the commissioner's review.
All right, this is a late filed exhibit by advocacy staff. This would be RSH. You want to be consistent or you want to change your exhibits?
Yeah, they should all be RSH.
All right, fine. RSH 13. And Mr. Grumman, how do you wish to have the exhibit described?
2009 capability study, unless you feel there's a more appropriate label, Mr. Nigam.
The one I was thinking in my mind, I believe, I'm trying to remember, deals with a load study in the Bismarck-Mandan area, which I think is really applicable to, we're talking about a resource that's located here.
So maybe Bismarck-Mandan 2009 capability study?
That'd be fine.
All right. Just a minute.
Yep.
Mr. Kuntz.
Your Honor, I spoke too early. Before in our reconsideration, we do have several questions for Mr. Nigam.
No, just a minute.
Follow up, but I can do those now or I can recall him.
No.
Are you asking to the late file exhibit?
Yes.
Oh, no objection to that.
Now we're on the track. Is Jeff Coates-Sacco?
No objection.
All right. Exhibit RSH 13, Bismarck Mandan 2009 capability study. Mark for the record as RSH 13 is received. Now, Mr. Grumman, anything further?
I have one further request. Would it be possible for MDU also to submit into the record a copy of the WAPA IS agreement? The most current WAPA IS agreement?
IS agreement?
Mm-hmm. The WAPA transmission service or the WAPA IS agreement for NIT service?
Whichever one I guess you based your costs upon. So I guess if both, then both. But if one or the other, then I guess that's the one we're most, we find most relevant in what we're requesting.
Okay. The existing agreement, if we're talking about the historical one that expires, would show what our at least capabilities or how much usage we're basically sharing between. And if we talk about the other agreement, it talks about how we're taking service and basically paying the WAPA network service rate today for loads above the what I would call our historical transmission service agreement.
We'll take both.
Should be fine.
Thank you.
How would you describe those, Darcy? This is RSH 14, then?
14, that's correct.
So it would be the WAPA transmission service, MDU WAPA transmission service agreement. It's the BAO 308 agreement.
And that's one agreement then?
Correct, with many exhibits. And then there is another agreement, which would be a network transmission service, WAPA network transmission service agreement.
I take it MDU does not object, Mr. Coates?
No objection.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No objection. Is that going to be one exhibit or two?
One. Anything further, Mr. Grumman?
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Follow up, Mr. Kuntz.
As I indicated, Your Honor, I have some questions for Mr. Nigam in response to Mr. Hahn's testimony. I can do those now, or we can recall them.
I don't see any reason to go through the formality.
I don't either.
Mr. Grumman, any objection?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No.
No, of course not. Proceed, Mr. Kuntz.
Mr. Nigam, does Montana Dakota study system reliability?
Yes, we do, as Mr. Hahn described that. As far as for both the Midwest Reliabilities Organization and for the MISO, we do, at a minimum, annual reliability planning that we do with the MRO and with MISO. And so those do have the year-out, 5-year, 10-year, as far as the future forecast that we do. And we also do reliability studies at least less than annual if we've got certain loads that we're looking at adding in our system as far as new points of delivery or service.
And you heard the testimony of Ms. Stomberg about one of the benefits of this locating the CT near the Heskett station or near the Bismarck-Mandan load was that was an improvement in reliability.
Correct.
Is that the same sort of reliability that you're studying when you look at reliability studies?
It provides reliability. It doesn't provide a solution to a reliability criteria problem or violation that's out there. So it basically adds to the reliability that we would have in the area.
It's not correcting kind of a reliability issue that it's out there. It just kind of adds to or improves reliability. Would that be a fair way to characterize it?
Yes, it would.
You heard Mr. Hahn's testimony stating that energy flow in MISO is generally from west to east, and that minimizes the likelihood that Montana Dakota would be unable to utilize the Illinois capacity.
Correct.
You agree with that?
I don't, because, you know, if we look at MISO and at least North Dakota, one of the things that happens at least is on peak, and the way that MISO models that there are flows that basically come back into this region. Part of that gets back to a predominant, the majority of the generation in the area deals with WAPA and Basin, and as we've seen, a lot of the facilities deal with the integrated system or the IS. So flows, even though at times they may go from east to west, particularly when you study on peak, which is when you look at capacity resource studies, or if you would also look at transmission service requests, you basically study those on peak in those situations, in which case the flows may not be from east to west, particularly out here in MDU service territory.
From west to east?
Correct, from west to east.
And did you recall Mr. Hahn's testimony regarding loop flow capability or applicability with respect to the WAPA charges and discussions that we had with staff following your rebuttal testimony regarding the WAPA charge?
Yes.
Can you tell us your recollection of that discussion regarding loop flows?
Sure. We had a conversation. We were talking about the two proposals, the North Dakota proposal and the Illinois proposal, and we started out with a conversation talking about the North Dakota proposal. We've already talked a little bit about, I described the issue at Hettinger, and as far as the concern on our system there and as far as flows want to go south out of there. And one of the concerns is as far as the potential for additional WAPA charges because of flows on the WAPA integrated system. And Mr. Hahn characterized that or asked if that was a loop flow situation, and I agreed with him that that's what they're concerned about in that situation. As we talked about from the North Dakota wind proposal was a loop flow. Then we talked later after that about the additional transmission service or network transmission service at Heskett, which is not a loop flow issue, which is more of a load serving issue.
And again, without beating this issue to death, what's the difference between a load flow versus loop flow or load service versus loop flow issue?
The loop flow is basically flow that you have on someone else's system, basically neighboring interconnected systems. When we talk more about this study and we talk about network service, we're talking about the ability to serve load basically from transmission facilities that either you own or that you're connected to.
And why didn't the company describe this WAPA NITS service, a network service, in either its application or its IRP as a relevant consideration in its selection of the CT?
I guess the issue for discussion came up when we had received Mr. Hahn's direct testimony, because he had pulled up the off-system resource that we would have had as far as relating to the Illinois proposal. At that place, when we started looking at that off-system resource, all of a sudden, from our standpoint, then it was, well, is there any additional cost adders as we're doing the side-by-side? So we looked at that issue. That's when it became relevant as far as from a conversation. You know, we did not include that. There was a credit, and we talked about the other simple cycle, combined cycle resources that we had along the Minnesota border that we modeled, because they weren't picked as far as in a least cost scenario. So it only became relevant with Mr. Hahn's direct testimony that we looked to include that to try to quantify additional costs associated with that proposal.
There was also the suggestion that Montana-Dakota's RFP bids may have been biased against out-of-state resources, or that we weren't selecting out-of-state resources and therefore not getting real responses to our RFP. Has the company basically excluded out-of-state resources in its response to RFPs?
We have not.
Can you explain, give examples of out-of-state resources that's utilized?
Sure. The out-of-state would end up being like the agreement that we have with Northern States Power would be an out-of-state agreement that we have. The agreement with We Energies that we have is basically an out-of-state resource. And the other one that we've currently signed is on the demand response program is actually with Constellation New Energy, who is an out-of-state company.
Have you received any feedback from RFP bidders about that MDU's RFP process is unfair or that it should be changed in some respect?
We have not.
Explain how the local generation, the benefit that Ms. Stomberg provides a real reliability benefit to load.
With the location of generation near load, there's the reliability benefit that's provided from that resource to be able to serve that load, one from a delivery standpoint. The other one is if a generation resource runs, it can be used for voltage support, particularly in the case where you're relying on long transmission lines or you don't have resources in the area, so it can avoid other facilities. Or the other one, that a generation resource can also offset the need for transmission or can mitigate transmission outages or congestion on the system.
Do you agree with Mr. Hahn's description of capacity zone differences in terms of ability to utilize credits?
No, my reading of the MISO tariff as it deals with credits and it deals with the market prices themselves is that all those prices will basically be settled within the zones that they're located. And the only way to move credits or to have some financial hedge is through the provisions I talked about. If it's the opt-out self-scheduling, or in the case of an off-system resources, through a grandmothered agreement.
So in your opinion then, would the company, in the absence of having that transmission resource between Zone 1 and Zone 4, be able to use the Illinois credits for its Zone 1 requirements?
It would certainly provide a limitation, or at least it would not provide us any sort of financial protection.
What's the time limit for exit from a MISO? Is it 5 years, as testified by Mr. Hahn?
No, it's a one-year notice.
And how could the company use a MISO credit, for example, in Illinois, if we're no longer a MISO member?
We'd either be in the position of just strictly selling it into the market and taking what the auction would provide at that time, or we'd have to rely on getting a transmission service request and moving that resource from Illinois to our system, which would be an off-system site for MISO.
And I'd like to touch on, can you explain why the combined cycle was not selected in the model?
It's not selected because it's not economical.
Why is it not economical?
because the combined cycle resources typically run in a situation where you have higher market prices. You expect those resources to run more than peaking, and so it justifies the additional cost expenditures of putting that steam cycle on and that steam turbine. And so from the standpoint of our system and what we're forecasting in our needs, it's not economical to add the combined cycle resource at this time, nor did the model select it.
And based upon the least cost modeling and the way you're projecting growth and energy needs and capacity needs, the model's not selecting a combined cycle unit within the planning terms of the model. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But the location of that combustion turbine, whether it's at Heskett or any place else, offers you the opportunity to do a combined cycle unit at some point in the future.
Correct. So in the future, when something comes along that causes us to look at the retirement of the Unit 1 boiler at Heskett, then at that point we're in the decision-making. Do we retire the unit and just get rid of everything? Or at that point we've got that optionality to see if the model would select it as a combined cycle resource in the future.
And at this point, do you have the retirement of Heskett 1 included in your Aegis modeling?
We do not.
So in 10 or 15 years from now, the decision is made that you're going to have to do something with Heskett 1 because of environmental concerns or whatever, and you now model that. Might that influence whether or not a combined cycle is selected then at that time?
It would be able to select that synergy if it was economical compared to other resources.
As a replacement for that Heskett 1 resource.
Correct.
Did the 2010 RFP require deliverability of full capacity to the MDU system for proposals that rely on resources outside the MDU system?
There was a requirement that we did have in the bid as far as that any off-system resource needed to have deliverability to MDU's system.
And how did the Illinois proposal respond to that requirement?
Their resource was located in Illinois, and the pricing would be paid basically at the Illinois nodal price.
So they didn't provide any deliverability assurance?
No.
Then?
No, they did not.
Are transmission service requests issued on a counterflow analysis?
No, MISO actually, when they look at transmission service requests, they have a separate model for that. And counterflow is not one of the things that I'm aware of that they consider for that, but basically look at all the other prior reservations and requests that have been issued out there.
And then finally, if you were to do a deliverability analysis study, what would it provide?
If you would do a deliverability study, it would tell you if you had the ability to enter into a contract for a transmission service request, or would tell you the level of network upgrades you had to spend to receive that. But the only way you get to use that ability that comes from that deliverability study is to pay for that transmission service request.
That's all I have.
Ms. Jeff Kotsacko.
I don't have any questions. Thanks.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
Can you say that last point one more time, that so I understand it, that because I think it gets the question that Mr. Hahn had raised, and gosh, you see this great price for
sure
that you received on this Illinois bid. Why not follow up on that more and do a deliverability study? Run. Say that one more time and
sure
maybe add context to it.
Well, the deliverability study is there's kind of, if we talk about we're looking at it as a transmission service request, because we're talking about resources that are already built, they're interconnected, they have those pieces in place. So our load exists and their generation exists. And you're really trying to say, is there a transmission path between those points?
Mm-hmm.
So the tariff allows you to make a request for a transmission service request. In doing that, MISO looks at their model of all the other transmission service requests that they have on the system, and basically using their power flow models, they basically determine, is there an ability to grant another resource, at least on that path, or what effect does it have? So they have to take into account all the other studies that are out there and as far as how the system itself flows. And so in doing that, it's not just saying that energy flows from west to east, so that if you just have a request that's counter to it or a counterflow request, it basically nets out against some other delivery.
So what's the impediment then to MDU requesting that, or what's the reason to not?
I wouldn't say that it's not. What happens is, in order to if you do that study, all it does is it does it at a snapshot in one time and says, would you be able to get this transmission service request? And other than just saying, yeah, we looked at it one time, it doesn't provide, as in the case of this grandmothered agreement, at least a path to move that capacity or to utilize that capacity in Zone 4 to Zone 1 unless you enter into and start paying for that transmission service request, which has an annual cost.
Is the annual cost knowable up front, or is that a
it's a tariff
risk that you kind of don't know what the cost will be on the back end once you?
No, we end up knowing that cost, and I think I had described that before. It's the MISO Schedule 7, their point-to-point firm transmission rate. And that cost, because you're going across the MISO footprint, is $2.44 a kW month, and that changes annually.
I'm sorry, you said 244 per
kW month.
KW month. Okay, thanks.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Kramer.
I just have one with regard to if I'm to accept the – I think I do accept the notion that a highly dispatchable 88-megawatt plant in Mandan – it enhances reliability in the metro area, certainly more than, you know, a purchase power agreement from Illinois. How reliable is reliable enough?
When we look at reliability, certainly we look at our system today, and as we look out through growth and through other projects that are added, keep looking at various contingency scenarios that exist. And so in the case, if we go back to December 5th, 2000 of last year, when we had the issue in Bismarck Mandan, you know, we have the potential for issues at times because the way that the system in Bismarck Mandan is set up, there's basically a 115 ring that goes around town. Right. And so it's that 115 loop that really serves all the load in Bismarck Mandan. And the generation at Heskett Station is located on that 115 ring. What happens is for additional transmission support, there's a 230 connection that we have over at the Heskett station, and there's also one that we have over at the East Bismarck substation. So typically we've got ample generation, we've got this 115 ring that's connected, we've got a 230 connection to 115 connection over at Heskett, and we also have a 230 to 115 connection over at East Bismarck. And where we ended up with is we had a generator step-up transformer for Unit 1 at Heskett failed. And when it did that, it caused Unit 2 to trip offline because the fault was so close in, located to the other generator. And subsequent to that, we lost the 230 to 115 transformer failed on the 230 connection that we had over at Heskett. So we've got two contingencies or two failures that have occurred. And so what happened then is we were looking at all of this load because we had no generation on the 115 ring was basically all being served from what we had being imported in from WAPA at East Bismarck. And that connection over there has 200 MVA transformers. So basically there were 200 megawatt transformers. And the concern ended up being if we lost one of those transformers, another failure, or we lost the tie to WAPA from that 230 to 115 ring, we basically wouldn't have been able to serve load in Bismarck Mandan. So that would have been the third failure.
Forgive me, but it seems like you just described a situation where the lack of geographic diversity created the problem, not solved it.
Well, it actually helps because the generator itself we're planning to locate it on the 115 ring. So from the standpoint of having another resource that we could have started quickly, the problem with the Heskett units, the GSU had failed, so we couldn't start Unit 1. Unit 2 being a fluidized bed takes almost 24 hours to basically bring it back. So we were scrambling and waiting until we could get that additional generator on over at Heskett Station. So if we end up having a fast start resource that we would have had, we would have started that, placed it online, you know, within 30 minutes, and we wouldn't have had any, you know, requests for consumers to conserve.
Very good. Thank you. All I could say is that there are a bunch of people in Fargo that would die to have that kind of system. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's another utility.
Commissioner Clark?
I remember my other question was, well, to talk about Heskett. Heskett 1 operates as baseload resource, is that correct?
It is a baseload resource, but both those units, Heskett 1 and Heskett 2, will cycle as far as the MISO dispatches them.
Oh, sure. I mean, if looking down the road and one of the flexibilities that's presented, whatever, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, and there has to be a decision made on Heskett 1 since it's an older unit, if it's to be replaced by a combined cycle combustion unit, which would require a waste heat recovery system on the so on and so forth, would the nature of this particular 88 megawatt unit need to change? Does that question make any sense? Because if it's, and maybe I'm totally misunderstanding how these combined cycle units work, but would it need to be running more constantly to really replace what's provided by Heskett 1?
And that's part of, you'd go back in as far as what's the economics of it. See, because the unit itself, if you had a combined cycle unit, can still run as a simple cycle turbine if you just needed it for peaking, mm-hmm. or if you wanted it to stay on longer or energy prices called on it, you could basically put the steam turbine on. So, but if you wanted it to run in a combined cycle mode and it would replace something as a baseload because the market required it or pricing, then basically you would go from a peaking to probably, you know, an intermediate peaking, something you'd start up and shut down every day.
Okay. And the unit as designed has that capability in it? I mean, just from an engineering standpoint?
It has that ability to start up and shut down, you know, daily or as needed.
Okay. That's all I've got. Thanks.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Calk.
Just one question, Dorsey. Tell me more about the nuclear resource that wasn't carried forward.
There were two proposals that were part of that. One was a wind only, and one was a wind combination with nuclear. So it basically firmed it almost like a fixed capacity and energy amount.
You don't remember where that was out of?
Iowa. It's out of Iowa, and we looked at that because you're paying for the fixed cost for that resource. It was very expensive, at least on a fixed cost basis. And I think even the pricing was higher than what our marginal cost resources are ourselves. So it's one of those, if you take it, you're almost like a price taker. You're buying a part of a larger plant, and you basically have to take the output. So what it does is it basically would have forced us to take some of our other lower-priced marginal units and either shut them off or be at risk that we'd be in the market, you know, and not be able to economically sell them.
So when the companies submit their RFP, then do you send them back, this is why it wasn't carried forward, so they get some feedback as to what caused their proposal not get carried forward?
We will send them a letter back, at least saying if they have been notified, if they're shortlisted, or if they're at some point, if they're ultimately, you know, rejected or thrown out of the process. You know, we have engaged, depending on the entity, time to time as far as, you know, feedback we might give them. Sometimes, depending where you're at in the process, might, you know, have some sort of a trade secret information, or you're providing, you know, some market information to them you probably shouldn't.
Further questions from the commission? Follow-up, Mr. Grumman.
Mr. Nygaard, there's been some reference to a deliverability study. How much does a deliverability study cost?
I think they're $20,000.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Kuntz?
Nothing further.
Ms. Jeff Kotsenko?
Nothing further.
Any follow-up from the commission? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Nega. Mr. Grumman, anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Kuntz, any further rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Jeff Kotsenko, anything further?
No, thank you.
All right. Closing comments from the commission. Commission Chairman Tony Clark.
Just thank everyone for a good hearing. Very interesting, and a lot of information for the commission to sort through. Of course, we have a few late filed exhibits that will be coming in, so we'll look forward to getting those and having an opportunity to sit down and talk about it at some point in the future. Thanks.
Commissioner Kramer.
Just the same. Thanks, everyone, for a job well done on all sides, and I can see why we got why we didn't have a settlement agreement in front of us. And I think that's just as well, quite honestly. I appreciate the opportunity for an advanced termination. As you know, I think especially that since there is a presumption, it's especially helpful to, and I'm grateful that it's brought to this point and that we have this opportunity, because there's a couple of important questions to answer. I think we have to nail down at some point whether this Illinois PPA ensures a Zone 1 capacity demand. I mean, we're going to have to get some assurance in my mind of that question. And, but look forward to the late filed exhibits and ongoing discussion.
Mr. Cook.
Just to thank you for your work, and I found the discussion today, I'll use the word fascinating, because it's interesting to me that there's companies that are generating in the central part of the country that are willing to send their energy all the way out here. And so I don't know if this is a trend that's going to be here for many, many years, if this is just something that's short-term because of economic downturns. But I think the whole model of, I think for the commission at some point in time, sitting down looking at some of the ways that we've run in the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years of how we regulate utilities is maybe needs a change. And some of those things today, I think, became kind of apparent. So thank you for your work today. I look forward to the first work session on this.
Mr. Kuntz, anything further for the record?
No, Your Honor. We would thank the commission for the time. Obviously, we believe that this is the best resource for us. We believe it's the least cost resource when you consider the risk of maybe not being able to use those credits, and not to mention when you start getting into things like the WAPA charge and the other benefits that this particular project brings. We're not afraid of power purchase agreements. We've entered into power purchase agreements for 30-some years to meet our capacity, and we'll look at them when they make sense. But when you look at where the market's at today and the questions are out there, it was just too big a risk for us to sign up with that much capacity from an area that we weren't sure we were going to be able to get here. And I would have hated to have been in a rate case 4 years from now and trying to convince the commission we ought to get recovery for that Illinois resource that we weren't able to utilize to serve our customers. And in the meantime, we were having to bid in the MISO auction. And maybe that was a small risk, but it's a risk nonetheless. And then when you consider the other costs of the WAPA costs that this turbine brings, the cost of delivering this capacity to North Dakota if you're able to use it, it just really wasn't a viable resource at this time. Now, maybe the market will evolve. Maybe the congestions will go away, and maybe someday capacity in Florida will be universally deliverable as capacity in North Dakota, but it's not there yet, and there is nobody, absolutely no one, that can assure us for the life of that contract that we would be able to use those capacity credits in our service territory. I mean, it might look good right now, but there is nobody that can assure you that that's going to happen, whereas we are assured if we build a resource on our system, we're going to be able to use it for the life of that resource. I think there, just to address a comment Commissioner Kramer made about, is this really designed to do a combined cycle? Why aren't we talking combined cycle? I think, as Mr. Nigam indicated, combined cycle right now does not make economic sense. And it may never make economic sense. But that being said, I don't think when you've got options in front of you, you don't think about what might happen in 20 years. And if you can locate it at A or B, or you can do C or D, and you might have some options that might make economic sense in the future, I think you put those on the plate, and that may, it's an added benefit. It gives you some flexibility you might not otherwise have, rather than waiting 10 years and then kicking yourself, why didn't we put this thing over at Heskett where we had this opportunity, knowing what we know right now. So do we have plans to convert this to a combined cycle? No. Based upon what we know right now, it wouldn't make economic sense. 5-10 years from now, it might well. But before we do that, we'll be back before this commission, and we'll have to convince you that it makes sense. But if we build a combined cycle, I think in any instance, it would make sense to have it at Heskett than it would any place else on our system. And then there's just, all the other benefits that flow from having an on-system resource as opposed to something in Illinois. So we appreciate your attention. I think this is, I found it somewhat fascinating, learning about this new resource planning construct. I've certainly learned a lot over the last couple months, and we appreciate your attention.
Mr. Grumman, anything further for the record?
I likewise, advocacy staff, thanks to the commission. I'll reserve my closing for written final arguments. Before we discontinue today, I guess I would like to discuss a briefing schedule.
Is Jeff Kotsacko, anything further for the record?
Only that we have to retrieve the trade secret material. Can't be taken out of the room.
That's being handled.
Okay.
All right. Accordingly, the consolidated hearing of the separate applications of Montana Dakota Utilities Co. for an advanced determination of prudence and for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct, own, and operate an 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine, North Dakota Public Service Commission cases number PU-11-395 and PU-11-396 is closed. Thank you very much, counsel.
Your Honor, and members here, we the exhibits that we handed out have the confidential trade secret information as yellow pages. We can either collect the notebooks or we can have you remove the yellow pages and we collect the yellow pages, whichever we want, but we have to collect the yellow pages. Okay. Whichever is easier. Thank you.
Council, Dan and
thank you.
I'm just trying to take into account like work session.